We're going to go ahead and get started. Call the meeting to order. Can I get a roll call? Oh, this is the first meeting of January 20th, 2016, and this is our first once a month meeting as voted in on in July 8th of 2015. So new process today. And new person. Can I get a roll call, please?
Jim DeMartini. Michael O'Neill.
Here.
Jeff Grover.
Here.
Donna Riley.
Here.
Sam Sharp.
Here.
Joan Clendenin.
Here.
Jason Gordo. Mike Lynch.
Here.
Gordon Ford.
Here.
We have a quorum.
Are there any announcements?
I actually have one. When I, you will see an amended 5G on your packet that we left at the table for you. What it is a monthly, did you pass that one out?
I did.
Okay. It looks like this.
But it has a little amended. It looks just like the other one.
It looks like the other one, but says amended. What's amended is I must have not had my bifocals on when I proofread the first paragraph because we didn't get $6 billion
in contracts. I wouldn't
imagine.
Yeah. I thought,
so,
really?
Anyway, it was a little over $6 million in contributions, and I fixed a couple other typos, so you just have an amended 5G there, and other than the crazy extra zero and the contribution amount.
Could you, when you amend something, underline it or put a scoring beside
I can do
it
that.
So we can, our attention will go right to the
I will
changes.
Do that. So that's it.
I have a couple of announcements. As a reminder, as announced at last meeting, the rotation of officers pursuant to bylaws section 1.5, Trustee Donna Riley is chair of the 2016 Board of Retirement, and Trustee Jason Gordo is the vice chair for 2016 Board of Retirement. Also, trustees have been provided with a hard copy of your 700 form. I'll also send those out electronically to you tomorrow, and the deadline is March 10th to get those back to me so I can get those filed with the clerk or recorder. Also, Benefits would like you to note that on the approval of retirement, the first one, David Camillo for probation, you may have noticed that that was on there on December as well. That was only supposed to be a correction of a date, so it's not a new retirement. He did come and amend his date, so it should have been listed as a date correction and not a new retirement. And that's all I have.
Okay. Public comment. Matters under jurisdiction of the board may be addressed by the general public before or during the regular agenda. However, California law prohibits the board from taking action on any matter which is not on the posted agenda unless it is determined an emergency by the Board of Retirement. Any member of the public wishing to address the board during the public comment period shall be permitted to be heard once up to 3 minutes. Please complete a public comment form and give it to the chair of the board. Any person wishing to make a presentation to the board must submit the presentation in written form with copies furnished to all board members. Presentations are limited to 3 minutes. So, consent items. Does anyone wish to pull a consent item?
Madam Chair, I need to recuse myself from 5J.
All right. Any other items? Then let's go ahead and is there a motion to approve the...
Why don't you have him step out of the room?
Well, I was going to say okay. Let's approve everything else okay. And if there's a motion for that.
I'll move approval of the consent calendar with the exception of 5J.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Then do you want to go ahead and step out? And you're going to tell me if I say something wrong, right?
You're doing great.
You keep me on my toes so I do this right. Okay, so the final item, now that he's removed from the room, for approval of item 5F?
J.
J.
I so move.
Okay.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Now, I'll go ahead and let him know.
Did he talk to you about that already, about why he recused himself?
No, he did not.
Sam, could we know why you recused yourself?
I know the officer personally.
Okay, but are you going to know most of the officers personally?
No. There have been several officers that have gone through, even in the retirement portions, that I'm not familiar with. Okay. There's a handful that I've worked very closely with over my career, and he happened to be one of them.
Okay. From my opinion, since you're elected to represent law enforcement, I think you get a pass on that. It's just if you would benefit personally from it, would be a reason to recuse.
Okay.
However, you can always choose to recuse yourself. That's a good.
And Sam, we can talk a little bit more about that later if you want, yes, with Fred, if he wants a little more education on that, when to and when not.
Okay.
We can work with you on that.
Okay, moving on.
So we're done with five.
Yep.
I'm sorry? Oh, yes, we're done with five. number six, Executive Director Administrative. Would that be you, Kat?
That'd be me. Going to speak to 6A?
No, we won't have to.
Oh, okay. This is an info. Go
this
ahead.
Is the same document that we were showing you last month. You know, we went over what where to look for things. And so we decided that we would just, rather than telling you all this information, you probably already read it. So if anyone has any questions, we would be happy to answer any questions. But if that's okay with you, we were just going to let you review it yourselves. Unless if you would like for us to explain it, we can certainly do that as well.
I did have a little,
sure,
a little question.
Okay.
Okay, so assessment, I understand what assessment means.
Mm-hmm.
And I know what RFP and vendor selection and contracting requirements. What does requirements mean?
The requirements, this is down in the bottom section. So under requirements, that's the phase that we're in right now.
Yeah.
This is where their specialists are meeting with our subject matter experts, and they are collecting what the requirements will be that need to be included in the
RFP. So you're developing the scope for the RFP.
Absolutely. Okay. That is exactly what we're
okay.
doing.
Okay. Yeah, that I understand.
Okay. Terrific. Thank you.
Did anyone else have any questions? Next item.
Okay. Item 6B. Kelly is going to discuss item 6B.
6B is the item that was before you previously, and the board and several other boards had asked for more information. So this is SACR's attempt to get you more education regarding their quest to go after the legislator. Or to put forth the legislative item. This is not, they're not asking for a vote today on whether or not we support it. They're just asking if we support the concept. They're just trying to get the temperature of all the boards to make sure that if the concept of this legislator is enough, then they'll move forward and it'll be at the next SACR's business meeting to vote yes to go forward or no. This is just them wanting to know the temperature of all the 37.
How do you differentiate between supporting it and supporting its concept?
Did you watch the video that they sent to us?
No.
Oh.
But I still don't understand
why the two votes.
I don't understand how you can support a concept but then reject what you're doing.
Well, what can happen is we can support the concept, but when they put it in writing and get all the T's crossed and the I's dotted, we may look at it and say we don't like that.
So
it would be like voting to even have it at their business meeting. If the vote here and throughout the other 37 axes, no, we don't like the concept, it will not be on your ballot then, most likely at the business meeting, at the next SACRS business meeting.
One thing that I thought was interesting in the video was that they were pointing out that they're not disclosing at this point what the actual legislation will read. And so that's not available to us, but would
or
we
allow,
or it, yeah. Right, well, I guess just the committee, probably they know what it, but they want to keep it close to their vest in order to be able to have a negotiating ability so that they don't have all their cards out on the table yet. So what they want to know is, can we include this in our platform to take the legislature, or do you not even want to go there? And I mean, it doesn't mean that the legislature is going to pass it. It doesn't mean that it'll, I mean, but...
It doesn't even mean that it's going to get to that stage
no.
of a written bill.
Yeah.
It just means that they're looking at it.
Yeah, and whether or not they are including it in their legislative packet is what they would like us to vote on today.
And it sounds like this is something that PEPRA started to deal with, but then backed away from when the legislature did when they were working on it. I don't see any harm in approving the concept. It seems to me like a very benign act on our part.
Yeah, I think they're asking for, like Kelly said, a temperature of the 37 acts before they spend any more energy in this direction. You know, they've already spent, I'm sure, quite a bit. And before they put any more energy into it, is there even enough of 37 acts that think it's worthwhile? So that's what they're asking. Should they even spend any more energy on it?
And it doesn't bind us
no.
to either supporting it, or even if it were to become law, it doesn't bind us
exactly.
to moving forward and enacting it here in our county.
Right.
It just would enable other counties, if it were passed, it would enable other counties to be able to act on something that they apparently feel is very important to them.
It gives them the flexibility.
I do have a question, and I don't know whether I've read this correctly or what, but it says that the board can approve going for one of these four formulas with no approval or concurrence by the county required.
Yes.
Does that mean they can do it with the Board of Supervisors? It doesn't make any difference what they think. They can do it on their
own. That's one of them.
Do you think the board would like that? Yeah.
I have no idea.
If we
can't articulate a reason to support it, or even a reason for it to exist, why in the world would we support the concept of doing it? It seems like it's a waste of time. I just read all the way through this thing. I didn't see one thing that it would attempt to accomplish.
And I don't know that in our county it would be something we would embrace.
But it's legislation other counties want.
Apparently.
That's
right.
What they're just, somebody else yeah. must want it. But I know that the three or four counties that have done some variation of it have had to start from scratch each time. And so
with the legislature.
With
right.
the entire process.
But is that a bad thing?
No, I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I think that's just where this is coming
I mean,
from.
I think if you have to start from scratch, then maybe you're doing all your due diligence.
Right. No, I don't disagree with you, Donna.
I think
the idea is, do you want us to spend any more energy on it? And that's what they're asking.
Are there any? So we can take a vote on this, can't we?
We can take a vote.
So
need a motion.
I have to kind of agree with Jeff. I don't know what problem we're trying to fix.
Could we go for a roll call vote?
Absolutely.
We need a motion
first.
Is there a motion?
I'll make a motion that we support moving forward with the concept of letting them work up the legislation. I mean, it's not our time, it's their time.
Is there a second?
A second.
Okay.
Roll call vote?
Yes, please.
Michael O'Neill?
Yes.
Sam Sharp?
Yes.
Jeff Grover?
No.
Donna Riley?
No.
Mike Lynch?
No.
Gordon Ford?
No.
Motion does not pass. 4-2.
So, moving on to the next item, discussion and action, executive director goals for 2016.
Right. The executive director goals for 2016 is that the staff recommendation is to accept these goals as presented. This particular item is 2016 is the last year of a 3-year strategic plan and action that was set forth. The goals are broken down into two categories. First is the general items that are either recurring in nature or tasks that are unique to 2016 but are not linked to the strategic plan, or tasks that are explicitly linked to the strategic plan. Staff has accomplished a lot in the last couple of years, but we still have some work to do. The first one that's not finished yet, and staff is actually recommending we either look at it further next year when we start looking at the 2017-2019 plan, or maybe even set it aside. That will be the board's decision. But that is contracting with specialists in the area of asset liability management in regards to developing a glide path that would put some triggers into place for removing risk off the table. Between the change of consultant and market expectations just not being what we thought they were going to be, turning out like we thought they would be 3 years ago, we think this is something that we should look at in more depth in the next couple of years.
So do I understand what you're saying is that the goal that was presented hasn't been accomplished and we are supposed to look in the future at maybe removing it?
Yes, exactly. Whether or not it makes sense. A lot of work was done on it, and there was education on the glide path, and I believe we even had one of our managers as well come in and talk about it. And the idea was as interest rates would go up, it would make more sense to look in this direction. And the market expectations are just very different than what was originally thought to be happening. So rather than make any rash decisions or jump into something, we are recommending that we look at it in a little more in-depth later in the future. The second one that we haven't yet accomplished and we're recommending we delay for a while is establishing policy and standards for the creation and maintenance of educational material and the development of efficient means to push out this. And that's partly about the communications position. It's also very much about our technology. A lot of what we're looking at with our IT solutions and our new websites and things like that is how are we going to go forward with putting this information together and maintaining it and getting it distributed. So it kind of fits right into the scope of the other IT stuff we've got going on, as well as the third one, which is just various enhancements and stuff. It's just not going to get done in a single year's time. There are a couple of tasks that are unique to 2016 that we're adding, and they're not part of this current strategic plan. We will be coming back to you to determine how we're going to move forward to develop the next 3-year plan. The county has expressed interest to Rick about a hybrid defined benefit and defined contribution plan. They're looking for more information. So that's an item that will be coming to you once we have more information. The facilitation of the IT solutions project, as well as the data cleanup project, that's an ongoing project that we're still working on. And we will be doing an RFP for actuarial services probably starting in February. So those items are, like I said, not linked to the plan, but will be happening in 2016. So, do you have any questions?
Are there any items that any member of the board would like to see added to the list of goals for this year? Yeah? Are there any questions? Then in that case, is there a motion?
Motion to accept staff recommendation Executive Director Bowles for 2016.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? I'm curious. All right. Okay.
Scoot on down. That's not a problem. Not a problem. We'll just scoot on down.
Yeah, it's up there.
Okay.
All right. Hey, good to see you all. It's been a while. You had sorry I wasn't able to make the last meeting. I know Chip was here giving you an overview of the demographic assumptions as part of the experience study. So I have a two-part presentation. It's good news, bad news, right? Let's go. We have to do the good news first, I'm sorry. But what we'll talk about a little bit is just the preliminary evaluation results, right? So our snapshot as of June 30th, 2015 of the plan, we've completed that work. It's still under peer review, still preliminary, but most of the numbers have been computed. I'll just go through the summary and highlights of that and what's changed since last year. Talk a little bit about where you've come from, you know, how your funded ratio has changed over time. And then we'll talk about the potential impact of the assumption changes. So Chip already went over with you, and I think you approved the demographic assumptions at the last meeting. We're going to talk briefly about what some of the options would be in terms of the economic assumptions and what impact that would have on the contribution rate. It's too early for us to actually make a recommendation because you still are doing some work in terms of your asset liability study, right? But we do have some preliminary thoughts on, you know, in looking at the portfolios that have been proposed, we have some sort of reasonable scenarios that we think might make sense, and we can see what the impact of those would be on the contribution rates for next year. Please stop me as I go through this. So here is the good news, that there wasn't a whole lot going on between last year and this year. Things were pretty close to what we'd assumed would happen. If you look at the top row, we're looking at the actuarial liability, right? That's the assets, that's your funding target, the assets that you'd like to have on hand to cover the benefits for the people that have been earned so far by your active members and by your retired members. So the actuarial liability increased slightly from just over $2 billion to just over $2.1 billion. As of June 30th, 2015. The actuarial value of assets, remember that's the smooth value. We're doing five-year smoothing to sort of smooth out some of the bumps and ups and downs in the investment markets. Those assets did increase from $1.64 to $1.76 billion. So your unfunded liability on a smooth basis actually declined slightly from 380 to about 360 million. And the funded ratio improved by about 2% to 83%. On a market value basis, so right, that's measuring your assets based on what they were worth in the bank as of June 30th, 2015, the asset value did improve, but not by as much. You did see an increase, actually, in the unfunded liability from about $250 million to $310 million, and the funded ratio actually dropped by about 2% from 87.5% to about 85.5%. Note that the market value of assets is still higher than the actuarial value of assets. What that means is, as of June 30th, 2015, you actually still had about $50 million worth of deferred gains in the asset portfolio. Considering what's happened in the last couple weeks, having a few deferred gains still in there as of June 30th, 2015 is a good thing in terms of what the impact is expected to be on next year's contribution. The net employer contribution rate actually went down. You know, I haven't been able to give that news very often over the last few years, but on the assumptions as of June 30, 2015, the contribution rate did decline by about 1.3% of pay. So what happened? Well, investment return on the assets as a market basis was about 4% net of investment expenses. So that compares to your 7.75% assumed rate of return. So you did earn less than your assumed rate. But when we take into account some of the deferred gains from the prior years, the return on the smooth value of assets was actually over 9%. So you had a $21 million gain. That actually caused about half of the reduction in the contribution rate, about 0.6% of pay. And again, you still have about $50 million worth of deferred gains that haven't been recognized in the asset value.
Can I ask you to explain that a little bit more and to take a look at the graph that's coming up on, which shows the gains and losses? If I understand correctly, what you're saying is a smoothing value, which is a five-year. We took the big loss and we spread it over years. That's separate. The gain that we took the following year in 10 is gone, right?
Right.
And so you're talking about 11, 12, 13, 14, 15?
Except that you're recognizing 20% of those investment gains, and right now what you have are more deferred gains than deferred losses.
That's what I'm trying to understand a little bit.
And you can tell that by looking at last year's asset values, right? So if you looked at the actuarial value of assets as of June 30th, 2014, the actuarial value of assets was $1.64 billion.
Right.
The market value of assets was $1.77 billion. So the difference between those is what you had still in terms of deferred gains that you hadn't yet recognized.
I was trying to get a sense from the diagram as to what years they came from.
I can pull that up for you through the presentation.
The 11, we had a loss, and 14 and 15 went again.
Oh, okay. So what you're seeing in terms of this graph, this historical review, this is based on the, I believe this is based on the smooth value of assets. So this isn't, you're not going to be able to look at this graph and determine how much of each year you're going to see over the next 5 years.
But we can determine where it came from, which years. For instance, 11 didn't provide gains, from what
right.
I'm seeing.
Yes, 11 provided
but
losses.
14 and 15 would have provided some gains?
14 provided, this is a smooth basis, right? So
yeah.
See, we're seeing here on 15, we have a smooth gain.
Yeah.
Right? That doesn't mean we actually had a gain in 15. We had a market value loss, right? But it just means the net impact of what had happened over the prior 5 years, as of June 30th, 2015, was a gain.
Yeah, I might make people to help. In 2012, the plan returned 14.3%, so that'd be a big gain. 2013, 19.8%. 2014, 6.9. 6.9 does exceed the 7.75 hurdle. It's coming from 12 and 13.
So it's coming from 12 and 13. Which means it will be given to us the next 2 years?
Those gains will be recognized over the next 2 years, right.
And that's a mathematical process,
yes.
Not something you change.
So each year, you recognize one-fifth of the prior year's gains and losses, as well as one-fifth of the gains that occurred over the prior 4 years.
Right, so that's mathematically, during the next 2 years, we'll be recognized the gains?
Yes.
But on the huge loss that we took, if I understand the other comment, we haven't chopped away at that in anything. It's a little larger.
When you say the huge loss, you mean 2008?
Yes. 2009.
Well, fiscal year 2009, that has been fully recognized. That's built in to the, that's been fully recognized in the actual value of assets.
Okay.
Last year, I think it was 2 years ago, was the last year we recognized a piece of that. Because we're past 5 years from 2009.
Right. But the statement you make, okay, where is it? At the bottom of that page you're on? The amortization period?
Yeah. Well, okay, so just going through this, the third bullet. The net impact of everything, right? The asset deferred asset gains basically reduce the cost by 0.6%. Everything else, when you add it all together, it's about 1.3%. So the asset gain was about half of that. And on the next slide, I'll go through a little more detail on what happened with the other items. The last bullet talks about a concept you may have heard called negative amortization, right? So the amortization period for the unfunded liability, right? You are amortizing that unfunded liability over a period of what's now 20 years. Back after 2008, that had been extended to 30 years. Then the board took action to shrink that down to 25 years. And since then, it's been coming down by one each year. It's now at 21 years. Negative amortization is basically when the interest that you're paying on the unfunded liability exceeds the payment that you're making towards the unfunded liability in dollar terms. And that can happen because what you're doing is called level percentage of payroll amortization, where your amortization payment is we're calculating it to stay level as a percentage of payroll, but we expect that payroll will grow over time. So we expect that the dollar amount of that contribution towards the unfunded liability will increase by 3.25% per year. That means that if you have a 21-year amortization schedule, in the current year, you're actually paying less than the interest on the unfunded liability, but you're getting very close to that tipping point. Under your current assumptions, once you get down to 18 years, then you're making principal payments on the unfunded liability. Under some of the other economic assumptions that we might be reviewing, that threshold could actually be as high as 20 years. So really, within the next year or two, you're likely to be making payments towards the principal on the unfunded liability.
So that I understand a little bit better, we took a loss in that year.
In which
year? Substantial loss in 09.
Yes.
Through this process, the amount of that loss has been absorbed or is still totally out there?
A portion of that loss has been fully recognized in your asset value, right? For a while, over a five-year period, that didn't appear in your unfunded liability right away. At this point, the losses from 2008 have been fully recognized and are a part of the unfunded liability as of June 30th, 2015. What you did in 2009, 2010, was to extend the period over which you are going to pay off not just that unfunded liability, but any other unfunded liability you had. And at this point in time, the period over which you're going to pay off all of your unfunded liability, including the 2008 losses, is down to a 21-year period.
So it will be a drag for us, although it'll be small, for the next 20 years?
It is a part of the unfunded liability that you are paying down.
Yes. Okay. And from the other part above there, the gains that we have will be beneficial to us for two more years, because that's when we had the larger gains. So what we're seeing is a larger gain benefit, which I think is 49, that'll be coming in the next couple of years, followed by a longer period of loss.
Now but what's going to really affect what happens to the contribution rates over the next few years is what happens over the next few years, right? So if you have, if you look at the markets as of today, right, you would have an investment loss, right? So that the losses, if you were to measure the assets today,
but only one-fifth of that would be
one-fifth of that plus one-fifth of the gains from 2011
right.
and 2012. So those, will tend to offset each other. So, what happens this year, next year, so forth, will affect what happens to the contribution rates, but because of that smoothing, any impact from a single year's gain or loss gets spread out over a five-year period.
Well, what I'm looking at is, I know the county's looking at a five-year forecast.
Yeah.
Does it in general mean we have, as they call it, a tailwind, where we have the benefit of the 49 billion, or do we have a headwind in the sense that we have to recover longer period of time the loss?
Well, as of right now, as of June 30, 2015, you had some tailwind. You had some tailwinds that were helping you, right? You
right.
still had $50 million in deferred gains. Obviously, what's happened so far in fiscal year 2016 has not been great, right? So who knows? I can't say for certain what's going to happen with contribution rates next year. However, what I can say is that the impact of the assumption changes that we're talking about outweigh the impact of these sort of moderate to small gains and losses that we're looking at on the asset value of the next couple of years. The assumption changes are going to create a bigger headwind in terms of the contribution rate than anything else that's happened over the last few years in terms of the assets.
Thank you.
When you say headwind, you mean that the employer contribution will be increased?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. I sometimes headwind, tailwind, I don't know. not terminology I usually use, but if I'm going to use it, yes, it's going to raise the contribution rate. So what happened, like specifically from last year to this year? Again, the contribution rate on the current assumptions goes down by 23.3 from 23.35 to 22.02%. Again, about half that reduction is due to the deferred asset gains. You have demographic changes, so retirement rates, mortality rates, that experience, that reduced the cost by about 0.3% of pay. And then payroll itself was actually slightly higher than we had expected. It increased by more than 3.25%. A large part of that is because your active workforce expanded. Remember that we're amortizing things as a percentage of pay, right? So we expect that pay is going to go up by a certain percentage. If pay goes up by more than that, it just means that the amortization payment is going to be smaller as a percentage of pay, right? You're taking the same dollar amount and you're dividing it by a higher payroll base. Same, the opposite thing happened when you weren't getting any pay increases and hiring was frozen. For a while, we had the contribution rates going up just because pay wasn't going up, so the amortization payment was becoming larger as a percentage of pay. Okay, so now we've got the flip side of that. When you started hiring some people, contribution rate went down as a percentage of pay, but that doesn't actually mean any change in the dollar amount of the contribution for the county. Again, we've left the change due to methods and assumptions blank here because, you know, we'll see what those are going to be. Any questions on this part? Okay. Just some historical review prior to any assumption changes. This is how your funded ratio has changed over the last, you know, 6 years, and it's improved, right? We had a sort of hit that bottom in 2009. Again, this is on the smooth basis. Those funded ratios shown at the bottom of the graph, but you were down to about 71%, and it's climbed to over 83% as of June 30th, 2015. Here we're looking at the employer's contribution rates. Contribution rates have increased, and they continue to increase over a period of time as you recognize those investment losses from 2008. There was some delay in the increase in those contribution rates because you did extend the schedule over which the unfunded liability was being amortized from 20 to 30 years. So now we've seen the last couple of years some gradual declines in the contribution rates because the 2008 losses have been fully recognized, and now you're seeing some of those gains from 2012-13. Again, this is just showing historically what have we seen in terms of the asset gains and losses versus liability gains and losses. And one thing to see is that, you know, generally your assets are going to bounce around a lot more than your liabilities are. So we haven't seen large changes in your liabilities from year to year, except generally in the times in which you have significant assumption changes. Okay, so that was the good news. The other half of the equation. What we're showing here are the total contribution rates. These are gross contribution rates. So this is employer plus employee under a number of different assumption sets. Okay, and again, this is for the contributions that will start July 1st, 2016, so fiscal year ending 2017. So prior to any assumption changes, we were looking at a total contribution rate of 31.37%. And again, remember that the employer is paying 22% of that as of June 30th, 2015, right? So contribution rate of 31.37. Based on the demographic assumption and changes that you approved at the last meeting, the contribution rate, gross contribution rate, goes up to 34.58% of pay. So an increase of about 3.2% of pay, most of that due to mortality assumption changes. Again, that's the gross contribution rate increase. So some portion of that will actually be covered by the employees. If you look at, we've broken down the change here into the change in the normal cost versus the change in the unfunded liability. And in terms of the demographic assumptions, the normal cost is actually slightly lower, looking at about a 20.1%. So not much change in the normal cost. So based on demographic changes, it's not likely that you would see a significant increase in the employee rates. because the employee rates are based on the assumptions that go into the normal cost calculation. What's the value of the benefits that people are earning in future years? What's increased is the share of the liability associated with the benefits that people have already earned. And that portion of the cost is paid for by the county and the other employers, right? The employees don't pay currently. They don't pay a portion of the unfunded liability.
Graham, so you would think at first blush that if people are living longer, then the normal cost is going to go up. But that also has to do with rates of retirement, I'm assuming?
Yes, okay. Rates of retirement and salary growth increases right. as well. Okay, so you've already gone, you'd already seen those numbers in terms of the impact of the demographic assumption changes. I think you saw them on last year's cost results, but they were, I think they're fairly similar when we applied them to this year's data. Option one is a different set of economic assumptions. This is an investment return assumption of 7.5% and wage inflation of 3.25%. So what that, and CPI increases of 3%. Right? So we're reducing the CPI assumption from 3.25 to 3. Basically, that's giving you a 4.5% real rate of return.
Which is what it is today.
Which is what it is today. So assuming that you are going to earn 4.5% above inflation over the long term, that would increase the costs by 5.6% of pay compared to the current baseline. And it's increasing it basically by about 2.4% of pay above the cost if you just had the demographic assumption changes, right? So it's an additional 2.4% above that 3.2%. A total increase of 5.6% of pay. So option number two is actually an investment return assumption of 7.5%, wage inflation of only 3%, and CPI of 2.75%. So in that case, it's actually a 4.75% real rate of return. Or a 4.5, we assume that investments are going to earn about 4.5% more than salaries are going to grow. Okay. The impact of that would be slightly less, so it would only be a 3.9% of pay increase, about 0.6% higher than just under those demographic assumption changes. So there, you're not looking at much of an increase in the contribution rate above what you'd already talked about in terms of the mortality assumptions. And the reason for that, why that number is lower, is that if we have a lower assumption about inflation, it means we assume that salaries are going to grow less over the long term, right? So that people's benefits ultimately will be lower. It also means that the COLAs, that the retirees, that you know, you have a COLA up to 3% of pay, we assume that because of the way the caps and the banks work and the everything else, we assume that if you have a 2.75% inflation assumption, that the COLAs are only going to grow by an average of 2.6% per year. So reducing that growth in the post-retirement COLA from 2.7 to 2.6 also reduces the liabilities. Okay. In both cases, we're assuming that the asset return is down to 7.5%.
Can you speak for a moment? I know it's always confusing between the figure that we're looking at when we talk the next section about the 10-year forecast of return of 7 or less versus the 7.5% that you've got up there and the differential between 7.5 and the,
sure.
the other figures.
The biggest differential is in that CPI, right? So I know you're going to be looking at a few different scenarios in terms of your investment portfolios. I believe some of them were, what, a 7% growth assumption?
You go from 7.1 to 6.1.
Okay. So the ones that are around 7 are also built in, I believe, a 2% inflation assumption, right? So they're assuming that inflation over the next 10 years is going to be 2%, and you can earn 7, right? So you can earn 5% above inflation. We're being a little more conservative than that in the real returns here. We only assume in that bottom scenario that you're earning
4.75.
4.75, not 5% above inflation. Okay.
And why is it there's always that difference?
Because we move slow. We're a you're a big ship, right? The assumptions that you use to do the actuarial evaluation are intended to be long-term assumptions over 30 years or more.
So right? They'll move slower than the other.
So generally, let's say, you know, inflation expectations change dramatically in a year, which they can do, right? Right. They could move from 2.5% to 2% or from 3% to 2% in a year or two. If that were to happen, it would be unlikely that you would change your inflation assumptions that quickly. Because what you're trying to do, one of your goals is to make sure that the plan sponsor has time to adjust to changes in the contribution rates.
Right.
Right. Don't swing the wheel all the way to one side and then swing it back the next year because expectations also change. So what you've been doing is looking at the markets as we do these experience studies every 3 years. Say, are our expectations still different than what, you know, maybe the markets are saying about inflation, and moving part of the way there, right? Moving part of the way in the direction of what the market signals are telling you. So a few years ago, your inflation assumption was 4%, right? That's come down significantly over the last 5 years. You know, one possibility we're looking at is 2.75%. That's a large change over, you know, maybe not a short period of time, but a moderate period of time. So in general, pension plans have not, especially public plans, have not adjusted their assumptions immediately when there are changes in the market signals for things like inflation.
So said another way, what happened in January really doesn't matter.
Right. So it may, if you were to say, look, we want to use a 2% of pay inflation assumption, you know, I would have a hard time saying that that's not a reasonable expectation. That's what the market signals are saying. So if you decided that, look, we want to adopt this 2% inflation assumption right now, I would say, in terms of an assumption, I think that's reasonable. But I think you also need to take into account how that affects the volatility and the contribution rates, and whether sort of slow and measured and regular review of your assumptions is maybe a better path than to make dramatic change in these very long-term assumptions in a single year.
And again, going back to what the county is doing in its five-year forecasting to try and figure out what's happening here, the rate of investment return is the more significant factor.
Generally, the rate of return, the real rate of return, what you think you're going to earn above inflation, is about twice as important as what you think is going to happen to inflation, right? So if you reduce your real return assumption by 25 basis points, you're going to double or more the impact on the contribution rate from a similar change in the inflation assumption. And you can see that here. It's actually more than double in this context because of the COLA caps. But right now, if you were to reduce your, if you were to have a 4.5% real rate of return, it would increase the contribution rates by 2.4% of pay. If you only have a, if you have a 4.75% real rate of return, so a 25 basis point difference in the real rate of return, that means it only increases the contribution rate by 0.6%. So that's less than half of the impact from the other assumption set.
So what we're looking at overall is probably going to lead in the longer term, say 5 year period, to a slight increase in cost for the.
This is not over a 5 year period.
No, I'm talking what the county's looking at.
Okay, so
if I take today and look 5 years forward, what would I anticipate going on? Given the math.
So let's say all other things being equal, you adopted these assumption changes today.
Right.
Let's assume nothing had, we don't know anything about the returns for fiscal year 16 yet.
Right.
What would happen is the contribution rate would jump in total from about 31.37 to 35.22. A portion of that increase would be paid by the employees because those more conservative economic assumptions, those do end up increasing the, you know, that would increase the normal cost, and the employees would pay slightly higher rates. But most of it would be borne by the county. So you would see the contribution rate for the plan sponsor jump up from, you know, by about 4% of pay if you adopted the bottom set of assumptions. That would happen this year, and then over the next 2 years you might see some slight decrease from those investment gains from 12 and 13. I do want to say that what some systems have looked at, and it's not in these slides, but we could discuss this as part of the next presentation if you would like, is a number of systems have made changes to their assumptions, but they have decided to, like they do on the assets, to phase in the impact of those assumption changes over a period of time. Okay. Most commonly, they've done 37 Act systems have phased in assumption changes over a 3-year period because that coincides with when you do experience studies. That's something that the California Actuary Advisory Panel, when we came up with that funding policy document, we said that that's a reasonable thing to do. That's an acceptable policy to phase in the impact of assumption changes over a period of time. And they recommended the period between experience studies. So if you chose the option one, which would increase the rates by 6.6% of pay in total, you could decide to phase in a portion of the impact of those contribution rates. You could phase the entire thing over a three-year period. Some systems have decided to just phase in the impact on the amortization period. They've said, let's absorb the total impact on the normal cost right away, because the normal cost is really the cost of the benefits that you're earning this year. We want to try to pay that in the year that it occurs.
Can you speak for a moment to the recent California attempt to levelize the individual and the county contributions?
Through the PEPR initiative that allows the imposition of 50% cost sharing?
Yeah, that kind of thing that's going on.
So I'd probably defer to your counsel on the impact of PEPRA on negotiated employee contribution rates.
But what I'm looking for is direction. I'm not looking for absolutes. I'm trying to get a sense of what's likely to happen over the next 5-10 years or whatever. And it appears to me that what's happening is the individual will be picking up a little bit more, the county will pick up a little less.
Believe it or not, your employees are already paying about half the normal cost of the plan. Right, the gross normal cost under the old assumptions here is 20.3% of pay. Right, this is on the top left number. That's the normal cost before any assumption changes. 20.3% of pay. Well, if we go back, the net employer contribution rate. Look what the amortization. Look what the normal cost is. It's about 11%. Right, so 11% divided by 20%. That leaves 9% that the employees are paying. So your employees are already paying about half the normal cost. For PEPR members, for new hires, they're paying half. So you right. will see a slight increase in the percentage of the normal cost that's covered by your employees, but it's not going to be dramatic because on average your employees are already paying about half the normal cost.
The normal cost? What about the other cost?
PEPR doesn't say anything about that the employees have to pay half anything associated with the unfunded liability. What it did give employers the ability to do is negotiate with their employees for the employees to pay a portion of the unfunded liability. But that's not something that can be imposed, and it's something that's just a part of negotiations, Fred. I mean, you can correct
that's why it becomes a subject of the time of negotiating the salary?
Yes.
Gotcha.
I have a question. Is there a difference between investment return on market value of assets and real rate of return?
Yes, the investment return assumption is what we call the nominal rate. All right. So what do we think you're going to earn in total? If you have a dollar this year, you're going to have $1.07 next year. Right. That would be a 7% expected return. The real rate of return is what do you expect to earn above inflation? Right. So if I think I'm going to have a dollar this year and $1.07 next year, and I assume I'm going to earn 7, if inflation was 2%, then my real return was 5%.
And it's the difference between those
It's the numbers. Difference between the total return minus inflation. And that's important because, you're like rates of return on bonds could be really high if inflation was high, right? You back in the late 70s, early 80s, you had, bonds earning 12, 13%, but inflation 16. Was 6 or 7 or 8% at that time, right? So when that happens and you have salaries growing, at those high rates, it means that your liabilities are also going to be higher. That's why we focus on the real rate of return, because what you earn above inflation is really what's going to pay down, going to reduce the cost of the plan. Right? Now, you asked the question about why don't we change our inflation assumptions rapidly, why are we using 3% when they're saying 2? Using 3 and the investment markets are saying 2, it is a little less conservative in terms of the contribution rate. If I reduced the inflation assumption and left the real rate of return the same, I would still see some increase in the contribution rate. Right? So the lower the inflation assumption, the higher the contribution is likely to be. And the reason for that is that your liabilities are tied to inflation, but they're not perfectly tied to inflation, right? You have COLAs that depend on the cost of living, but they also have other things that affect them, like the cap on the COLA and, you know, the banking and so forth. So just because your liabilities are tied to inflation, it doesn't mean they're directly correlated with inflation.
But we're using the CPI that for the Bay Area, which would be
higher than
the national.
Oh, yeah. CPI came out today, so I haven't even told Rick this, but I had our staff calculate what your COLAs are going to be for 2016. And you may have heard that the CPI increased by, if you round it, it increased nationwide on average by 0%, by 0.2%, which under your formula you would round that to zero. Bay Area, 3%.
Wow. You mean 2.8% higher than the national?
Actually, slightly less on December, but you use an annual average.
Right.
So you're going to be, your employees are going to be getting 3% COLAs this year. If you
leave this room, by the way.
So if you exclude the cost of housing, the CPI went up. Bay Area, the CPI went up by less than 1%, about 0.8%.
So that's really
totally driven by the cost of housing.
That's retirees, yeah.
Yes, that's for the retiree COLA, not for the active employee COLA.
That's interesting.
We are on recording.
You know, so, yeah, sorry to spring that on you, but I thought it would be worth sharing. Okay, so...
That's not factored into our liability that much.
That's... So, again, under both of these assumptions... We already assume that your COLAs are going to be 2.7. So even if they're 3, it's not a big loss.
Okay.
Right?
Good.
The difference between your COLAs going up by 3 versus 2.7 is going to be vastly outweighed by whatever happens in the investment markets during fiscal year 2016. So what are our next steps? We need to finalize the experience study, so you'll get that big book from us that tells you, you know, has all the details, especially on what Chip, you know, presented last time. You've already adopted the demographic assumptions. We've shown you a couple economic assumptions. These are all what we would consider to be reasonable assumptions. Even the current assumption could be, you could call that a reasonable assumption. The one caution I would have is that you would be one of the last systems still at 7.75, if not the only system still at 7.75 by the time next year's valuations come around. So plan, or at least among the 37 ACT systems. So whether that influences your decision or not, I don't think that's necessary, but it is good to know sort of what your peers are doing. And everybody's sort of been coming down in both their inflation assumptions and what their expected rates of return are being, especially given your investment consultants are saying, look, we think you're really only going to earn something like 7% over the next 10 years, right? So, again, the assumptions that are on the last slide, they're all reasonable, but you know, our recommendation in the report is likely to be something, you know, a little lower, like 7.5%. We do still need to do a little bit of work reviewing the administrative expense assumption with staff. We know that they're, you know, might be embarking on some technology projects and so forth. We need a long-term administrative expense assumption, but we have seen higher expenses over the last few years, and we need to figure out if that's going to be a recurring thing. We need to finalize the valuation results. Again, all these results are preliminary. We're still proceeding with our peer review, and then at some point, over the next few months, we need to adopt the June 30th, 2015 valuation, which will determine the fiscal year 16-17 contribution rates, both for employees and employers. I have some appendices with some numbers. Again, the one thing that was relevant here is that the active member payroll increased by just under 7% of pay. A lot of that was due to that large safety increase. But again, that's why the contribution rate went down as a percentage of payroll.
So that chart is saying what?
Average salary only went up by about 2.9% for each active member, but you had a 3.8% increase in your number of active members. right? So that's why your total pay went up by over 6%. You went from under 4,000 active employees to over 4,100 active employees. Okay. Happy to answer any questions.
Anything you need us to do today?
Nothing I need you to do today. I'm going to stick around for the asset liability study. I'd be interested if you want to have any kind of a discussion about the I'm not going to be able to bring a whole lot more data in terms of the economic assumptions. Ultimately, this is going to be a decision for this board. So if you'd like to have, or at least begin that discussion today after you've sort of made decisions about the asset allocation, I think it might be a good time to have those.
Can we go back to the prior slide? That slide. Can you find out that's the net employer contribution?
So here's where we've broken down the total contribution rate into the employee versus employer, right? So as we said, if you look at the normal cost, and again, this is before any assumption changes, the total normal cost as of June 30th, 2015, with no assumption changes, would be 20.3%. The employees are paying 9.3%, so that leaves the employers paying just under 11% of pay. So again, the employees are paying
a little less than half, but
getting close to half of the normal cost.
And this is saying that the net employer contribution rate would drop
from 23.3 to 22 if you didn't make any assumption changes, but you have already adopted those demographic assumption changes. So at a minimum, that net employer contribution rate is going to go to somewhere north of 25% pay.
Gotcha.
Right? If you look back here, the impact of the new demographic assumption changes is about 3.2%.
So that's just kind of a partial showing as opposed to the other things that are factored in.
So if you add 3.2 to the employer rate here, you're looking at something like 25.3% of pay before you've decided to make any, if you make any changes on your economic assumptions.
So without changes on economic assumptions, there's going to be a slight increase in the contribution rate.
Right, from 23.35 to something north of 25.
And then any assumption changes would add to that.
Any economic assumption changes would add to that.
Gotcha.
Right? And basically under option two here, we're talking about 0.6%. Under option one, we're talking about another 2.4%. And there will be some changes to the employee rates, but those are likely to be pretty minimal based on what we're seeing in terms of the change in the normal cost.
And this is all just math. You don't need our vote or anything.
Nope, don't need any votes today. Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, so next up is Ferris.
Oh, you did.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, thank you. We'll get our slide show.
Are we ready to go?
Yes. Good afternoon. Happy New Year. Haven't seen you since last year, so time flies. Hope you're enjoying the football playoffs more than I am, but I'm not a fan of any of the one of the four teams, so it's kind of up in the air for me. Handed out separately from the bound materials is the December performance update. So just a quick glance at that, you can see that year to date, this is still preliminary. We're waiting a few more numbers, but we're looking at coming in basically flat for the year, down 0.8%. A lot of that driven by this last month, down 1.5%. Nothing particularly notable across the investment managers, aside from Dodge and Cox. They've had some personnel changes over the past several months. So in late November, they made their first announcement that Gregory Surrier and John Gunn would both be retiring. Monsieur Surrier would be retiring at the end of March. Mr. Gunn retiring at the end of December of this year. So that's natural Dodge and Cox, well-planned, well-telegraphed, no surprises. Neither of these gentlemen had direct investment input into the strategies in the plan, but they did both sit on investment policy committees, so I guess in an indirect way they had an impact. And then more recently, actually earlier this week, they announced several promotions, so backfilling then their retirements and bringing some new people on board. Kathleen McCarthy is being added to the Investment Policy Committee. David Heft to join the Global Stocks Investment Policy Committee. Roger Kuo to join the board of Dodge & Cox, Inc. And Stephen Gorski to be named to the Business Strategy Committee. So, again, they maintain long tenure across all of their personnel, and so it doesn't look to be disruptive, but it's something that we want to pay attention to because if we do start seeing other changes, we'll want to note that and keep it in mind. On page 2 of this handout, I would just note that the final values for the direct lending and real estate strategies were not in yet, which is typical. It takes them a little longer to finalize their numbers. So we don't have quite that. And then CPI, which is used in the calculation for the policy index, was, as Graham just mentioned, it just came out today. So that is an impacting the numbers just yet.
What was Southern California CPI?
One.
One?
Just got that.
And so we get no benefit at all from the raise in property values because our property values didn't grow that much.
You mean like Modesto?
Yeah, right, like right. Where we live.
You're just getting penalized.
Right,
by
okay. There's that hadn't been said.
There's nothing, though, that precludes us from looking at a different base to calculate COLAs. No, I've read where you can actually, they suggest you look at different areas.
I think the 37 Act requires you to use the closest.
I think I've read somewhere where somebody was suggesting a weighted average of certain areas up and down the
state. Some places have used a weighted, yours historically has used an average of the CPI for all the different monthly periods, for the bi-monthly periods, but it's always been CPI Bay Area. And I believe...
So the CERL says specifically Bay Area for us?
CERL says, I think, the closest to where the county is located. Mm.
I think that's the way it reads, because we've looked at it in path going, this is crazy, why San Francisco and it says closest, I believe.
Yeah, my friends down at Merced, they're even further. Come on.
Even if we average the state or something.
Yeah.
Why don't we see if there's... Into office, our senior staff put together a wage survey that included Sacramento, San Mateo, several much bigger and much higher wage rate groups. And we decided that the aid in the valley would be our peer group. And it changed things quite a bit.
Let me research it a little more and see what I find.
No, well, they do now, but they didn't.
Part of the issue is that
there's only like one county in the valley, and everybody else was big.
Okay. Part of the issue is the BLS doesn't.
But when you throw in Merced, Monterey,
Indices? Yeah. It's there aren't that many metropolitan places that are large enough that the BLS will actually compute the CPI.
But if we did the whole state, then that would be that'd be a goal.
I don't think BLS does a California. I think it's by metropolitan area.
I am not so sure that's true, actually. I think the BLS does have a weighted average for California of different regions. I looked into this 2 or 3 years ago. It's been a while, but there's something that's going on in the back of my mind.
I'll look.
No way.
Happens more often than that.
I would fully understand.
Let me look.
For this report, we're actually using national CPI because the investment strategies that use CPI or try and get CPI plus 4 are thinking of it on a national basis. So they're looking at the national statistic. I think that one came out this morning at something below 1. I think it was 0.7 or 0.8, something like that. Yeah.
And with fuel doing what it's doing, it's got to be really taking a
that's right.
Big bite out of it.
That's right. That's right. It is. Okay. Any other questions on the performance report, or should we move forward? Let's move forward. Okay, great. So tab 1 just has the November summary performance. I think we can skip that given that the December is more current. Tab 2 has what we like to call the enterprise risk tolerance. And I think this is a fun little exercise that we'll walk through here. So if you take a look at tab 2 and go to page 4, what we highlight here is enterprise risk tolerance is a concept that we try to get articulated and have in our thought process as we think about the asset allocation. So it's a clear fundamental building block because it sort of sits as a guardrail for us. It's kind of something that we want to keep in the back of our minds. And the schematic on the right-hand side of page 4 kind of shows that these two dimensions, what is your willingness to take risk and what is your ability to take risk collectively as a board? And so the ability is really a function of how strong is the plan sponsor. How much investment risk can we take without putting the plan sponsor in jeopardy? So that's ability. Now, your willingness is typically lower than that. Most people look at it and say, well, I don't really want to get too close to the boundary line there. I don't want to push that. So my willingness, I'm going to dial that back a little bit. And when you put it on this chart, you think about if your ability is really low because your sponsor, your employers are strapped, tight economic conditions, and your willingness is low, you're kind of in a protective mindset. If your ability is higher, but your willingness is low, you're more defensive. So you're not looking to take on extra risk. If both ability and willingness are high, you're kind of capitalizing on investment risk. Let's go for it. Let's see what we can get. And if your ability is low, but your willingness is high, well, then you're just kind of naive. Then that's something we need to talk about so that we don't run afoul of those issues. So that's what the schematic introduces. Now we take a next step into the trustee interviews. And I still haven't completed all of them, but we're going to move forward. And if there are any objections, we can certainly vet them out. So page 6 starts off with the first one, and that's just, what is the mission? What is the mission of Stansera? And there's a very high level of consistency here, which is why we say complete consistency, and that's to ensure the payment of promised benefits. And that's just the uniform response we got from everyone. That's what the mission here is for the retirement administration. The objectives, high consistency, so maximize return given an acceptable risk threshold. And there are several other considerations here. Meeting the assumed rate of return, very natural. Balance risk and diversify portfolio. Reduce chance of large losses. Establish sound rationale. And a couple comments about socially responsible investing, which is what SRI is. So generally, the mission is very consistent. Page 7, time horizon and how we think about measuring our success against that mission. There we get some different answers. And so here we're looking at some say 3 to 5, some say 10, some say more than 20, as long as 50 years. And chances are you're probably thinking, well, all of the above. I mean, let's measure the plan against everything and let's pay attention to where we are. And there was also the sentiment that it kind of depends on the issue. What is it we're trying to measure against? Is it an individual strategy? How is that strategy described to us? What should we expect it to do through certain market conditions? Are we being fair by looking at it on a 3-year basis or 5-year? What's the right number there? So it kind of depends on the situation. and I think those are all valid points as well. On the right-hand side, we do note that a longer time horizon implies a higher level of risk tolerance because we can wait out down markets, and so we can accept higher level of risk knowing that we expect those to return to normal at some point in the future.
How does that fit in normal of other plans? I mean, the 3 to 5, 5 and 5 above, that's kind of the category that one looks at?
So the 3 to 5 tends to be the area we see most groups evaluate individual investment strategies on, because most of the investment managers come in and say, give us a full market cycle. And a full market cycle tends to mean something in a 5 to 7 year range. So 3 years, you have a good sense of where they're going. 5 years, you pretty much know. And then you just kind of have the context that maybe this business cycle looks a little bit elongated, maybe a little bit shorter. And then overall, a lot of groups say, let's look at it over a 30-year basis or a 40-year basis, keeping in mind that it is a very long liability profile. Page 8, we talked a little bit about investment philosophy and simple versus complex. And so a little bit of differences here. Investment philosophies are complex, and a $1.8 billion portfolio warrants more complexity. Preference for simplicity with acceptance of complexity if warranted. And then a differing viewpoint that is more just simple and direct. Keep it as simple as possible. And I think that makes, trying to find the balancing point between these is probably something along the lines of as complex as necessary, but no more complex than that.
Complexity the same as reversibility?
They're tied, so they're related. The difference, I think, is that complexity can be introduced from mainstream investment asset classes. You could have a very complex large cap core strategy, and you'd look at it and say, why are we hiring that level of complexity? We can get something much simpler, much easier to understand without having to go through that. Other times when you get into like private equity and private credit, you've heard those managers present to you before, those strategies are naturally more complex because of what they're trying to do. So they're related. Investment philosophy on page 9, so continuing this, we asked about active versus passive strategies. And heard generally high consistency that there's room for both. And we tend to agree with that. In fact, we'll have our annual active management environment research piece coming out soon. And it highlights just that. It's an interesting piece that uses sort of cloud graphs to show individual asset classes and where the clouds fall out over different time frames against median manager performance. And it gives you a sense that when you take a look at the manager universe in general, are they taking on more risk to get higher return? Are they taking on more risk but not getting higher return? And you start looking at them at different time frames and you get a sense that here's where I want to spend an active management dollar because I do think there's merit in it versus, no, they're just playing a game. They're just dialing up risk to get extra return. And if we want to dial up risk, we can do that. We don't need to hire a manager to dial up the risk for us. So it'll be an interesting piece. I've seen a preview of it, similar to last year, but with some updated numbers. And so I would expect we'll have that for you at the next meeting. On page 10, we touch a little bit on public versus private. High consistency here, general role for both. And what I'd note is that when we take a look at the asset allocation study and we consider different options, there are some very different options in this regard. So we're showing you some that have a whole lot allocated to private equity and private credit, and others that have much less. But you also see that when we take a look at those, that our capital market assumptions generally favor privates. And it's not because we have a bias towards privates, it's just that the numbers play out that way, that we're seeing higher 10-year expected returns, reasonable standard deviation, and nice combinations when you put them into a portfolio. So there is a lot of merit there we see from an investment perspective. But you also have to be aware of liquidity, because a lot of these private investments, you can't get the money back out very easily. You're making a 10-year commitment or a 7-year commitment or something like that. Page 11, we touched a little bit on liquids versus illiquids then, so nice dovetail into the liquidity issue. And here we saw pretty high consistency. Illiquidity is fine as long as operational needs are met. And right now, if we take a look at the portfolio, we are a very liquid portfolio, maybe too liquid, because we are not taking advantage of the illiquidity premiums. So we might want to consider changing that. Page 12, thought leader versus safety in numbers. So here we get into a little bit of peer risk. And so how do you view yourself against the other Sackers counties or other public pension plans in general? And we saw high consistency that the group is in favor of being a thought leader, which we liked. We also know that that can be really challenging when the numbers are down and other numbers are higher. You wish you weren't a thought leader in that point, but it doesn't feel like you're leading much thought at that point. But it's also important to note that your liabilities are unique. And so what you're trying to do, regardless of the performance numbers, is to satisfy and fulfill the fiduciary duties you have to your participants, not to anyone else's participants. Page 13, we have investment risk. And did not really identify a broad definitional theme. So we saw a few different components here. Volatility, the general ups and downs of the markets. Drawdown, losing a lot in a short period of time. Tracking error, how we measure ourselves against our benchmark. And here we have a recommendation for maybe spending some time on education session on risk management. And you've started to see the risk dashboard come out in the performance reports. And so far we haven't talked a lot about it. I'll kind of introduce it to you and give you a chance to get a little bit familiar. But the interesting thing about a performance report is it's really backward looking. We're looking at what already happened, and it doesn't give us much guidance for the future. And risk dashboards don't give us a lot of guidance for the future either, but they prepare us for the future so that if something does go wrong, what's going to happen to our plan? Did we know that? Were we surprised by it? And so that's really the middle part that risk dashboard helps us understand. The forward-looking piece is whenever we talk about our quarterly investment landscape, what we see in the markets, and what the eco-political dynamics are going on there. And that can help us with the valuation. So you put those three together and you have a pretty nice full picture. Right now I think we've been largely focused on the performance side. And so getting some risk component in there coupled with the market outlook is, I think, will be helpful. Page 14, we touched a little bit on organizational risk. And do we have any key person risk or board turnover? And some dispersion on key persons. So two schools of thought. One is that staff is light and tight, and so any departure from staff would definitely have an impact. The other thought is that, yes, staff is clearly important, but we are also supported by a number of outside professionals, the board, and the staff itself has some built-in redundancies to some extent, so that if any single person were to leave, we'd still be up and running just fine. Board turnover, general consistency viewed as low, which is nice. No one here thinks of themselves as the linchpin to making it all happen. But certainly your roles are naturally turning over anyhow, so it's something you've come to expect. Page 15 on environmental risk, taking peer risk into concern. High consistency here, not a concern. Similarly, headline risk can be a bit of a concern if there's miscommunication. I think that's true. Anytime there is headline risk, we'd like to be the ones constructing that story and being helpful in creating it. We've seen from other counties and other situations, you don't always get that opportunity. Sometimes it's written for you before you have a chance to opine on it. And then the second phase of the enterprise risk tolerance starts on page 17, where we take a look at the health of the sponsor. So again, thinking about the willingness, which is the trustee interviews, this is more of the ability to take on risk. And first, we just take a look at the credit ratings. And so these credit ratings are a little bit dated because of the timing that they come out. So these go back to 2014. But we get some commentary from Moody's and S&P. We get their ratings, A1 from Moody's, AA- from S&P. And then you can see how that stacks up against other counties. So very much in line. We also have the pension funded ratio here, looking pretty strong relative to most of the counties. A couple others are higher, but not many. Outstanding pension obligation bond, the county doesn't have any. That had been paid off, so that's zero. County revenues, 800,000, that's, or 800 million, that's probably higher today, I would guess.
Do you recognize the tobacco security as a liability of the county or not?
That's a good question. You tell me, how should we think of that? That's
Well, the county's official position is it's not.
Okay.
The auditor disagrees and says it is.
I would have to get more familiar with that issue.
It's a big issue.
Okay. On 14, we have the long-term obligations. Okay, so here's the tobacco securitization note, accounting for 57% of long-term.
Yeah, that's why I say it either exists or it doesn't.
Yeah. So I guess in that respect, this would be viewed as a liability.
Yeah, I'm questioning that.
So the other key points, though, in the text on that slide are that there is a debt limit of 1.25% of the value of taxable property. And so the county's assessed value is $35.6 billion, and the legal debt limit, therefore, is $445 million, and currently well below that.
Is it 3-1? Is it 158 million to 445 million?
Yes.
Is that the ratio?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So current obligations are 160 million. The capacity is 450.
So there's almost $200 million more dollars that could be borrowed.
Right.
That's assuming you accept the tobacco. You can take it out.
Right. It's even more. Yeah, it's another 90 million.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So we're in good shape from what our value is to what we've borrowed.
Right. You have a very nice balance sheet. Yep.
Thank you.
On page 19, taking a look at a couple of the debt ratios, the charts at the bottom, debt as a percent of revenue, low, debt to assessed value, low, and debt to general fund, debt payments to general fund a little bit higher. And so we note there in the bottom bullet point that the 9% comes in a little bit higher than Merced and San Joaquin. And then slide 20, the revenues. So taking a look at the balance sheet, that we looked at that and that looks pretty good. Taking a look at the revenues, we said that these are pretty stable. We see the increase into 2007 and 8 and coming off in total county revenues on the bottom slide, on the left-hand side, 20. And then property tax revenue, fairly stable. And non-tax revenue to total revenue is also relatively stable, somewhat high. It's about 59%. And so that's, we dissect it that way because the property tax revenues tend to be more stable than other forms of revenues.
I need to be picky, but on the debt payments, we're not paying the tobacco.
Okay.
So there's no charge on that. I don't know if you picked it up or not.
Okay. And then 21, taking a look at the economic and demographic statistics. We have the population growth, generally positive growth except for 2011 and 12. Looks like it recovered in 13. Income per capita increasing throughout this time frame. Unemployment rate coming down to about the 10-year average, around 12%. So generally a higher unemployment rate here. And then
I think this year is down about 8%. It's taken a pretty big hit.
Down to 8%.
Yeah.
Nice. And then 22 highlights employment by industry. So it's nice to see a pie chart that's well diversified across leisure, government, health and education, wholesale and retail trade, principal ones. And 23 has top 10 employers.
Processing, or is that part of manufacturing.
Part of manufacturing.
I would guess processing is not part of farm. Because farm gate is like what, 4 billion?
About 4.5.
And a total of about 12 or 13 billion.
Mm-hmm. But it's not revenue generated, it's employment. So I wonder if that includes seasonal workers and so on, or if it's just full-time employees.
Twenty-three showing employment by the top 10 employers, and we see food and beverage pretty high contributor there. So this is of the top 10 employers. We're seeing 4.7% in food and beverage, education at 2.6, healthcare, government are the top industries across these top 10. So overall, I certainly appreciate the clarifications, because you're obviously a lot closer to this than I am. So we're doing this from reports third hand. But when we take a look at the summary overall, I think it remains on target. And if we're not on target, then we should definitely clarify this. But counties' credit ratings, high and stable. Mm-hmm. Long-term debt obligations, well under the legal limit. If we take out the tobacco, even lower. Total debt relative to revenue is very low, which indicates good coverage. And county revenues have remained steady throughout the last few years. Improving unemployment rates, which we note is even better than what we're showing here if it came down to 8%. Stable population growth and diverse employment base. So a nice, strong county. Able to weather some storms. So that gives us some comfort then, as we start taking a look in the asset allocation, about how much risk we can really think about taking.
I'm feeling a little bit sacrilegious even asking this, because okay. I hate the concept of pension obligation bond. Right. But when you look at something like Fresno's over $500 million, and Sacramento's almost $1 billion, have we looked at trending on towards 83% funding, mm-hmm. and there's a difference about $300 million from 83 to fully funded?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So have we looked at the stress to the county that if we did a pension obligation bond for $300 million and were fully funded, what the employer contribution would be and the employee contribution would be to pay for the bond, as opposed to the actuarial rates and all those assumptions that go on?
Great question. So I would be a contributor to that discussion. I don't know that I would be the leader.
It seems like we should at least look at it.
We can. I mean, that's a very complicated discussion. There's a lot of pros and cons to the decision to do that, and we'd have to look at them all.
I'll tell you, who's the con guy is Paul Angelo. He does not like pension obligation.
Well, I could sit here and talk about POBs for the next 15 minutes. I have a very strong opinion about them, but this is not the right time, I believe, to do that.
But we borrow money. It would be like financing your house. Okay? there's a finite discussion over
Absolutely. Whether
it's a wise thing to do or not.
One of the things you have to realize is when you do something like that and you take all this money and you give it to the pension fund, you're essentially borrowing money at a fixed rate and investing it in a risky portfolio where you could lose 20, 30, 40, 50% of your money. So there are huge implications on issuing pension obligation bonds.
Graham, could I ask you a question?
Sure.
The concept of taking the 09 loss and deferring it over 20 years is very similar to a pension obligation bond over 20 years, isn't it? In the sense that you're paying thing over time?
Except that the pension obligation bond, as Rick says, you're making fixed payments.
It's real money.
But actuarially, aren't you doing that on your debt?
Because your debt is going to, your payments on your debt will change over time as your investments go up and down versus pension obligation bond, and it wouldn't be you.
So that deferred debt, I'm talking about just the deferred debt part. Just the deferred debt.
There's no relationship also when you go out and borrow money to fixed rate, there's no relationship between you're having to make debt payments and the county's revenue streams coming in. They don't work together.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
That's a huge problem.
That's true.
And at least for the actuarial process, we have a little bit of flexibility in terms of changing the actuarial rate when things aren't going so well.
Yes, a lot more flexible.
One tiny other thing is that a lot of people don't realize about a pension obligation bond is as soon as you fully fund your plan, you've actually made the contribution rate even more volatile.
because you have more money invested.
To lose.
Yes.
Or gain.
Yes.
So there's no leverage.
Well, I mean, it does. I mean, it levers up the...
It's the wrong way.
Risk and right. contribution.
But it's not arbitrage. A lot of people, I used to get the argument right. that that's arbitrage play, and it's not an arbitrage play.
What's okay. the difference between borrowing personal money and going to White Club and when betting on it?
Yeah, you tell me. I mean, that's, again, I have my opinions on that, but we all have our opinions on that. We can have this discussion at a later date if we like. We can definitely agendize this for a later time. It's a good discussion to have.
I'm not. I let off by saying I hate the concept, but it seems like we should at least have told people we looked at it, because obviously. Someone else in the world thinks it's a good idea.
And it probably comes down to what's the goal as well.
Rick, is there a point in time in funding ratios that's critical that a bond bringing you into that critical area is important? Like if you're below 80% funded or below 70% funded, it's different?
I'll let Graham answer that question.
I don't think there's a specific critical number that applies across all plans. There was this myth that 80% funding ratio was the gold standard, and the Academy of Actuaries actually published a paper called The Myth of the 80% Funded Ratio.
Thank you.
So, no.
I will say one thing. Some of these could be from a long time ago, too, Jeff, some of these balances that are out there, because I believe it was mid-2000s or early 2000s when I was working elsewhere where I started getting a lot of requests on that. But again, the main argument then was some of the municipalities in Southern California really thought that this was an arbitrage play. That was the big impetus for doing something like this at that time. But again, I think a lot of these could be from a while ago.
Yeah. Okay. Just a little side effect on that. And we had one once.
Yeah, we extinguished
it. Paid off.
Yeah. 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 It was a $190 million pension obligation bond in '95, I believe.
They just when we paid it off, we used the county's annual debt by like $13 million a year.
So I hear about it from the arbitrage perspective,
and
we don't buy into that.
Yeah.
The other question, I guess, would be what is the goal? I mean, if you were to try to get to fully funded so that you could annuitize and shut down the plan or something like that, that there could be a storyline there. If it's just to get to fully funded status so that you're at fully funded status, myth of 80%, myth of 100% too. I mean, it would be, you know, kind of okay, great, but what does that accomplish for you? At the end of the day?
You have had some, like in Illinois, you've had some pension plans that think it's a great idea because otherwise they don't know that they're ever going to get the money to pay the beneficiaries. So as a trustee of a pension plan, they like the idea because then they have the money. And when they don't know that they're actually going to get contributions from the sponsor, it's a lot different in California.
Yeah.
Okay.
Great. So, that's the last page of the enterprise risk tolerance. Should we move on to the asset allocation?
Question, yes, sir. You started off the discussion by looking at the graph.
Yes.
Now that you put the facts out there, can you kind of give a little interpretation on where we are as it relates to what page was that?
Page four.
So the ability for plan sponsor seems that it would be pretty strong.
It does.
Yeah.
It does.
Oh, so probably past the midpoint?
Probably past the midpoint and probably higher than what we thought. And, you know, I think having this discussion was pretty helpful. So I think we probably collectively, but I don't know. I mean, if there are dissenting opinions here, let's hear them. But I would say that the ability is probably pushed out higher. And I think from interviewing each of you, the willingness is generally moderate to low. So we would probably fall into this defensive quadrant, probably the upper left-hand side of that defensive quadrant.
And capitalizing would mean that we have a tolerance of risk to the point that we may be able to end up a little bit better than the peer group.
Right.
But we have to be willing to take the risk.
Exactly.
And our plan sponsor is probably able to do it if we choose to.
Right.
When you say capitalize, do you mean capitalize on our long-term nature of liabilities so we can be a little more illiquid and capitalize on those premiums that we can get?
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. That's right.
So I have a question. You said that our willingness is based on the interviews and not necessarily on the information that we discussed at the asset allocation study?
Oh, the asset liability study. Yeah. So this discussion focused on the trustee interviews.
So when you say not willing or less willing, mm-hmm. did you get that sense at the asset liability study?
A little bit. So part of the asset allocation study today is I'd like to push the thinking a little bit on that and see where we come out. A little bit. That's just, you know, that's my sense of it. I suspect you come out on a different side of that one, so.
Interesting.
Okay, should we turn to tab 3 then? Yep. The asset allocation study. So if we turn to page 4, we have the quick schematic of a plan profile, giving us where market value of assets are, a couple months dated, a quick synopsis of our cash flows. And the cash flows are interesting, this middle section. Total contributions of about $6 million per year. I'm sorry, that's per month, $6 million a month. Benefit payments of $8 million a month, 8.4. So we're paying out more than we're getting in, so we have this reliance on interest and dividends, which is good that it's coming in at 3.67. So net-net, we're positive cash flow of about $1.3 million per year. So important to recognize that reliance on the income and dividends, that's a key component of how we're paying things. And part of that is reflected in the maturity of the plan. So we show the participants close to 9,000. 47% of which are active, 14% inactive, and about 40% retired. So,
wait a minute, what page are you on again?
I'm on page 4. I'm sorry.
Third
section. Tab 3.
The interest in dividends, you're talking about what we actually receive on our portfolio that's invested if somebody's paying us a dividend.
Page 4.
Or cap rate.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
Capital.
And then the accrued liabilities, a little over $2 million, at the 7.75%. And so the assumed rate of return, which I thought Graham did a nice job with the previous presentation. So, you know, I think this is just an interesting thing that we also see boards kind of go through this process of saying, well, we want to pick the asset allocation that's going to get us closest to our assumed rate. And they forget about what the risk profile of that is. And it's like, oh, okay, that's one way. But I think if you had Graham and I discuss it, you'd probably hear that it's really an iterative process, that we want to think about the risk, we want to think about what that portfolio can generate, we want to create a realistic assumed rate of return, capturing our differences in inflation, what have you, so that it's kind of an iterative process, because then we take the numbers and he'll run them through his model and come up with his expectations and so that kind of thing. So it's not necessarily a healthy exercise to just say, which one's closest to 7.75, let's go for that. So on page 6 and 7, we start showing you some mixes. And mixes 1 and 2, just high level, page 6. Mix 1 and 2 are what we showed you at the asset liability study. Mix 3 is designed to create a diversified portfolio without taking on as much in illiquid assets. And the reason why we do this is illiquid assets are an operational consideration here. Knowing that we don't have investment staff to run the portfolio, keeping things simple is a benefit, can be a benefit. Or hiring investment staff is another alternative there too.
Is there a way to relate this interest in dividend 3.67, which gives us the 1.4 that we have excess, to these various mixes, whether we'll still maintain or what amount we'll lose?
Yeah, we don't show that. That's a great question. We don't have that.
Because if we, from what I'm reading, if we were to take half of our investment interest out and put in things that would be long-term benefit but wouldn't provide the interest in dividends, we could be below our net cash flow.
Ah, right. So what we do is we show it on a total return basis, so we don't break it out into price appreciation versus income and dividends. We just show it total.
But one you get immediate and the other you may not get for 5 years.
Well, and we, because we don't have any tax consequences of selling,
right,
we can create our own income policy. So
if we have liquidity.
If we have liquidity. That's right.
Okay.
That's right. So then page 7 takes us through our current options here. So first thing I want to note is we took out the hedge fund line to, in total. I realized that was a toxic word. I heard that in the interviews. It was validated during our last discussion, so that has been deleted. Maybe we'll cross that bridge some other time, and maybe we don't. And so we have the policy and the current, generally pretty close. Currently, we're underfunded on real estate against our policy, and we're underfunded on private credit, so there are some differences here. And at the bottom of policy, you see the allocation to illiquid strategies is showing at 14%. That's designed to capture how much we allocate to real estate, how much we allocate to private equity, and how much we allocate to private credit, knowing that these tend to be longer lockup terms.
Now, am I correct that those would then be the ones that would not have the dividend interest agreements? They would be capital gains later.
Actually, private equity, private credit, real estate all will generate income for us.
Okay.
So policy and current. Mix one and mix two carry over from our last discussion. Mix three is the more simplified version. And what we're doing is we're taking private equity down to zero, which we're currently at, keeping private credit 7.5, which we're currently at, introducing risk parity, and keeping real estate at 6.5%.
Can you define the risk parity again?
Yes. Risk parity is a group of, it's kind of an asset class, but it's really a set of strategies that the managers have the freedom to go across all asset classes. And they construct their portfolios based on the risk contribution from each asset class, so that their portfolio is balanced across interest rate risk, equity risk, whatever else, fixed income risk, however they view the world. And so they construct the portfolio in that way, which requires them to take leverage, because interest rate risk in treasuries, et cetera, is pretty low. So for them to dial up interest rate risk, they have to buy more than that. So they have to actually lever that part of the portfolio up. They tend to hold less in equities. But what they tend to do together as a portfolio is they tend to essentially create what we're trying to create, a balanced portfolio that does well through all economic regimes, doesn't have a lot of downside exposure, so it tends to do well during drawdowns and generate a consistent 7% return.
So they're gaining that not through equities, but through bonds, through what? What are they actually going into?
They can. They generally can invest in everything. So they'll be able to invest in stocks and bonds globally. Some of them will do privates. Some of them will do commodities. They'll do all across the whole fixed income spectrum. And what they do is they put together a portfolio where they say our target volatility is X, 10% or 12% or something like that. And we're going to manage that volatility number really closely by trading all those different asset classes. And so that strategy tends to create a 7-8% return, or whatever the percent return is going to be, against that volatility number, but they really manage to the volatility target.
Actually, that becomes your riskiest part of your portfolio if you're leveraged.
No, actually their leverage is really tightly managed. I hear you. Leverage, if managed improperly, can kill you. And what they do is they have stops put in place so that if drawdown occurs, they back off the leverage and pull it out. And the volatility of that portfolio naturally increases because of the market volatility. So they're still getting the market volatility that they want, but they dial that back. And so it's actually pretty effectively managed.
I think we need education on what that is.
You do. It's not something we would step into today.
What types of turnover ratios are there in the risk parity?
Like 300% kinds of numbers. They have very high turnover.
So there's a fair amount of fees that are involved?
Fees tend to be fairly low, actually, because they tend to do as much as they can through passive strategies. And so they'll try to keep the fees low in that way. Yeah.
So if they're accurate, you're okay, but if you're not accurate, you can have trouble.
You can. I mean, you'll have investment risk like anything. If we presented you with a search of the candidates that we work with, you would see how they perform in down markets, and they generally do pretty well during down markets. So if you wind back to 2008, they did a really nice job of playing defense there.
And high yield, you think that was the same thing as junk bonds?
Yes, sir.
How risky is that? You get down to what level? Are you talking about DD or DD?
Well, that would depend on the manager that we hire and what guidelines we give that manager. But generally, it would cover the spectrum, and they would probably be on the higher end of the junk bonds. Most of them tend to be, because those are the managers that play better defense during down markets. But they'll have the freedom to go all the way down to not rated. They won't go. They won't buy defaults, but they'll buy triple Cs.
And nowhere in here is any commodity.
No.
Commodities. Except in your risk parity.
Exactly. Commodities showing up in risk parity, we think, are a better way of doing it, because that will have active management buying and selling commodities at the right times, rather than just having a default 5% allocation to commodities or something like that. As we've seen, commodities can have quite a bit of volatility. So.
I think commodities are so good right now.
I don't think so, Rick.
No, I don't think so either.
You can buy gold, silver, whatever you want.
No, there's no explicit.
In our policy?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nothing explicit.
Policy, that's a good question. I don't know.
As far as I know, there, and I've read that document
well,
two or three
written.
Times.
Yeah.
So I don't recall any restrictions on commodities.
I thought it was. I could be wrong.
That's not an issue at all, though, today, right? Commodities.
Yeah, risk parity. But, yeah.
Yeah. And that's a small amount, I would assume.
But
if you're giving them freedom, they can go where they need to.
I mean, we can adjust the policy if it does exist. If there is restrictions.
Page 8 is a different way of looking at the portfolios, and this is a different approach based on the functional role within the portfolios. And when we take a look at the three portfolios, the FFPs, 2, 3, and 4 year, FFP stands for Functionally Focused Portfolio, with the idea that portions of the portfolio serve different roles for us. And so when we talk about liquidity, which is this top section, and we break it out into cash and short-term gov credit, low volatility, fixed income securities, short maturity, be there when we need it, very high liquidity. This portion of the portfolio is designed to pay benefits. And the labeling of these asset mixes, 2 year, 3 year, and 4 year, is to say that, well, we can allocate this much money to these asset classes based on benefit payments and expenses for the next 2 years, 3 years, or 4 years, so that you as a board can rest comfortable at night knowing that benefit payments that come up tomorrow are met. They're paid for. We got that in the bag, and we have those in very safe, secure instruments. The next section is diversifying. I'm going to hold that one till last. And the third section is growth. How do we grow our portfolio aside from the benefit payments and expenses? So we know we have an increasing obligation in the future. Let's figure out how we meet that. And so this part of the portfolio is designed to do it. And you'll see that we're allocating to a lot of the growth sections, like large cap equities, like international large caps, emerging markets, very little to fixed income, actually none. And then you have to get down to the real estate, private equity, and private credit. And why is that? Well, this growth portfolio is basically saying, okay, if we're going to have our cash nice and safe and sound, and we want to grow the rest of the portfolio, what are the best return-generating opportunities to do that? And the right-hand side has our 10-year capital market assumptions. So it shows the return and volatility expectations for these asset classes and saying, okay, well, we expect the highest producing asset class to be emerging markets over the next 10 years, 11.5%. So we want to get a slug in there. We want to get a slug in international large cap, 9.5%. We want to get a slug in private equity and private credit, 7.8 and 7.7, and diversify that a little bit with the large cap equities, 5.7, and real estate, 5.1. And those are the areas that if we allocate to those, that gives us the best expectation for growing that portion of the portfolio. Now, if you sit back and pause on that and you say, whoa, you're telling me that we should have 13% in emerging markets, 15% in private equity, 15% in private credit, why would we do that? You would do that because the volatility of those asset classes and the lockup period on the private assets are something that we can basically put aside for the future and know that our 4 years of benefit payments are met, or three, or two, whatever the number is that we would decide on. So it gives you comfort that, yeah, you're taking that risk. It's almost a barbell risk approach. Collectively, you're taking about the same portfolio risk as you do in the other portfolios, but you're barbelling it because you have so much in short-term safe stuff and so much in long-term risky stuff.
Really taking advantage of the long-term nature of our liabilities is what we're doing here. We do have, that's one tremendous advantage that pension plans have, is they don't need a lot of liquidity, and that's what these three mixes capitalize on.
That's right.
Emerging markets haven't done very well at all.
Exactly.
One of the worst investments you can have outside of oil.
That's right. So timing is really important. And right now, this would create a better buying opportunity than a selling opportunity if we were to play in that market. We can also hire international equity managers who make that call for us as to how much to put into emerging markets and when. So we, depending on how we structure the mandate with them. But that's exactly right. You know, we have this chart that is the periodic chart of returns, kind of like the periodic chart of the elements. I've shown it to you before. And that emerging markets number has been the top for 5 years in a row, and then the bottom, and then the top, and then the bottom, bottom, bottom. And it is that volatile. Over time, it generates pretty good returns, but you have to be able to wait that out.
We're retirement system, you know, we shouldn't be in really that risky market.
Well, it's that's a concern. So when we take a look at the volatility here, we have a 23.7% number for emerging market equities. That's consistent with private equity at 23.7. And it's only a bit less than domestic small and mid-cap stocks at 19.8.
You know, you're more subject to political instability and exchange rates still with emerging markets. I wouldn't put any money into it.
So we're at 3.7% now, right? In emerging markets.
Correct.
Ed, would you explain to me just a little bit more on the volatility number
that yes.
it's representing? I obviously, there's a low end and a high end, but
what's it mean?
Yeah, what does
that
think
mean? About it? Yeah. So the volatility is just a measure of how much the returns vary over time. And so we get the return number, and we think about what the return is. And if you could get a return of whatever, 2%, but it has zero volatility, you could bank on that because that 2% is almost guaranteed, right? But when you get a higher number and you start seeing that it's a 5 or 10 or 20% volatility, then we expect that return to generate, but it's going to have some real peaks and valleys in doing it. So it's kind of like a signal to noise ratio kind of thing. It's like a
looking at a percentage. 76% of the time, we're not dealing with any volatility.
Okay. So a way to think about it would be, what would be a reasonable expectation? So if you had a 10% expected return and a 15% volatility, having a negative 5% return or a positive 25% return is within one standard deviation. It's what you should naturally expect.
Two out of every three events.
Two out of
lie three. Within that range. Okay. Yeah.
So it explains, yes, that's a good way of thinking of it. Two-thirds of the time, you're going to be within that range.
So the lower the number,
the better.
Closer we get to 1-to-1.
The more certain you are of hitting that return, that expected return.
Wouldn't that be more in the capitalizing category than defensive category?
That would be.
So it seems that you're appealing to the wrong audience.
Actually, not quite. Actually, what I would come back with is, let's take a look at page 9 before we reach that conclusion.
Okay.
Because page 9 then says, okay, so we take these asset mixes, put them together, and think about them given not only their return expectations and their volatility, but also their correlations with each other, because these things we want to create portfolios that different asset classes are going up and down at different times, so that it smooths out our assets returns. And page 9 helps us think about that. So the top line here is the forecast 10-year return, and they're all generally around a 7% kind of number, as high as 7.2, and we're currently at about 6.1. Standard deviation for the total portfolio, this is interesting now, so we're currently at about 11%. Mix 1, 2, and 3, basically within the same zone. I mean, the level of precision here, let's not get too tied up on one decimal point. They're basically 11% portfolios. FFP 2 and 3 actually dial it down into the 9s, and FFP 4 takes it back to 10. So across all three of the FFP options, even though they have more allocated to private equity, private credit, real estate, and emerging markets, in totality, these portfolios are less risky. And so it goes back to that barbell approach. That anchor that we have sitting in the short-term gov credit and sitting in cash helps diversify that tremendously. And so the one part I didn't come back to is the diversifying component on page 8, which is the second tier. Shows that U.S. Treasury and risk parity and what those allocations are as well.
No, you're going to earn a low return on your short-term and your U.S. Treasury, right?
Correct.
So you're going to make it up on your growth.
Correct.
So to get your 7.1, you're going to have to be earning, what, 9 to 10 on the growth?
Yeah, depending on which portfolio you're talking about, yes. Yeah. Probably 8s. Probably getting 8s. We have, depending on the allocation to emerging markets, we see private equity and private credit coming in right below that, and the 5s on the other strategies.
Two-thirds at 8 and one-third at, I don't know what fixed in, you're going to figure 3-4. It's not going to get you to 7.
Yeah. Take a look at risk parity as well, so we get the 7 there.
Oh, we're going to pick up the money and
so there's, depending on the allocation.
Okay.
No, risk parity is not your gamble.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
You and I differ.
Well, let's do the education session on it, and let's take a look at the searches, and we'll take a look at why I don't think it's gamble.
Okay.
So the other interesting components here on the mix is when we take a look at drawdown risk. And so on page 9, the fourth line down, we have the first percentile return 1 year. And so here, this is one measure to say how much could this portfolio lose in a year. We're currently looking at our current portfolio about 23.4. Mix 1, 2, and 3 actually bump that up a little bit, 24s and 25. And the FFP 2, 3, and 4 bump that down, 21-22%. Sharpe ratio is just a measure of efficiency. How much return are you getting for your unit of risk? So that's just a quick way of comparing portfolios. A higher number is better. And then various economic scenarios. And you can see how they play out. Page 10 then takes us through a chart that takes a look at our exposure by asset class. And you can see that our current portfolio has the high weighting to equity. So in 2016 year to date, we would not expect our portfolio to be doing well because it has the high allocation to equity. Every other portfolio seeks to draw that down. Mix 3 is probably the most aggressive, maintaining 50%. The others take a more balanced approach towards the exposure across asset classes. And then slide 11, rather than allocating the dollar amounts, this is allocating risk and showing that the sources of risk here were principally driven by equity risk today, 10.4%, and across the other portfolios you can see that. So today our gamble is basically on the equity markets, and the gambles that we're looking at it in terms of the alternatives are trying to diversify those across the others as best we can.
So how would you define the gamble on the private equity? You're saying that, say, on the PPF 2 year, you've got 4.2% risk on the equity and 2.9% risk on the private equity. If you say we're risking the stock market going up, what is the gamble on the private equity?
So I'm not sure I understand the question. So
how do you describe what it is that the risk is?
So the private equity risk is equity risk, like what we have across all equity components, tied with an illiquidity risk as well.
Okay.
So you have the illiquidity premium.
So let's see if I can try it. If we're buying into private companies, they do well or they don't do well.
Sure.
The risk is that we buy into companies that don't do well.
Right.
Okay. So we have to have a manager who understands all the small companies and can choose the best ones to be in.
Right.
And our faith in that has to be better than our faith on the Dodge and Cox or whoever that's doing the stock.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Isn't that an investment that's really difficult to get out of? You get in the private equity.
Yeah. Yeah. Private equity structures are generally 10-year structures, but it's not locked up in terms of you put your money in today and you don't see it for 10 years. What they do is they give you a funding schedule, and so they're going to talk about how they expect the money to be called over time, and then the realizations that are going to happen. So their realizations come from whenever they sell the company or take the company public or what have you. And so those realizations happen throughout the life of the portfolio. Capital is called in the first 3 years, 4 years, some time frame like that. And so that's a part, that's a key component of what we'd want to consider when we look at that.
Would we buy into a private equity fund just into a particular business?
That's right. That's right.
So that they would have a whole range of companies they're invested in that are IPOs and selling out and going in. So there's cash flow within the fund.
In fact, we'd probably do a private equity fund of funds so that we would probably work with a manager that gets us into multiple managers who are investing in multiple companies. So that's probably the most efficient way for us to get exposure to that market.
Now, when we went into the private equity credit, we were told that in the event it really went south, we'd have to take part of the company, which we didn't want. Mm-hmm. We're trying to avoid it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Here we're going directly into owning part of the company.
That's right.
Okay.
How many retirement systems have done something like that? You know, the private equity. I really am.
Oh,
how common is this investment?
It is very common.
We're probably a real small percentage of retirement systems that happen there.
That's right.
Really small.
How correlated are returns between private equity and private credit? Because if we sum the two, it's a fairly large allocation to the private space.
I guess that would depend on the private equity is large or small companies. If we put all our stuff into small companies, if the economy has trouble and the small companies move back, but the big companies survive, that'd be a high risk. So it depends on where you go.
I guess, though, there'd be a strong beta correlation between those two asset classes.
And I bet it'd be a small correlation to smaller companies rather than it wouldn't be going into Exxons or whatever.
That's right. That's right.
So we're saying that the small part of the private sector will do better than the big part of it. Because right now we're very heavy into the large U.S. equity.
Correct.
So we're saying, no, we want to be into the small mom-and-pop type of operation more than the big, huge, multi-billion-dollar company.
A lot of that has to do with liquidity, too.
Yeah, I wouldn't characterize it as mom-and-pop, though. There is a lot of...
Mom-and-pops can be big.
Exactly, that's true.
Is Gallo a mom pop?
You've got your correlation at 0.13 in your matrix.
Oh, thank you. I was trying to scan through that. So.
Why is it so small? I would not have guessed that.
That would be a return stream correlation, so I wouldn't have...
Okay. I guess I'm thinking of how the economic environment affects both investments. I would think a lot of the same exogenous factors that would affect one would affect the other as well.
Well, the private equity world, once you start getting into it, you start dissecting it. So, you know, venture capital is a small piece of the private equity world. You think about VC work here in Northern California and how prevalent it is, you probably run into it daily. And probably since the dot-com era, you've been running into it daily. And it goes through its ebbs and flows. But that's just one piece of it. There's other tiers to it that they're doing more middle market buyouts and things of that nature, where they're going and they're taking one of those public companies, sometimes pretty large companies, taking them private. And they're saying, okay, we're going to take it private, we're going to restructure it, do whatever we want, and then maybe they take it public again or whatever, mm-hmm. and they can get a realization like that. Mm-hmm. When they do that, they tend to take it private, they tend to lever it up, because its balance sheet is usually clean, and they'll get to put some debt on it, and that'll amplify the returns, and then they'll dispose of it how they want to. They don't tend to want to own these things for forever. So when they have a 10-year horizon, they tend to want to get in and manage that individual security through the next 5 years, because by the time they acquire it, fix it, change management, what have you, and then sell it again, it takes that long. So then at the end of the 10 years, you're done, but they've already come back to you asking for more money for the next one.
So Kraft, for instance,
yes,
did that kind of stuff.
Yes.
What type of economic environment would portend really bad times for private equity? What economic environment would we come back and say, shoot, that was a mistake?
Yeah, great question. So 2008 is a great example, because what happened there was a lot of the investors who were in it didn't understand and appreciate the liquidity component and said, we want out. And so they tried to exit. Well, that's tough to do. If you're going to exit before the money is being returned to you, you pay a pretty hefty penalty mm-hmm. on it. But they wanted out because they had the liquidity demands from the rest of their portfolio. So they're like, we have to get out because. And so that created just a negative cycle then in amongst everything else going on in 2008. So the companies themselves, the portfolio companies, weren't doing well either. So you want out, well, okay, we have to sell at a low valuation. What we're telling our clients is to think about is recognize that liquidity constraint up front. Don't be surprised by it. Second is, if you ride that out, you can have some very attractive opportunities. So what came out of 2008 was the whole secondaries market. And the secondaries market was just that, where people wanted out, they didn't have anywhere to sell, and a buyer would come in and buy that private equity component on a secondary market, but it wasn't a publicly traded stock exchange or anything. They could come in and buy that as a secondary offering, and those have done extremely well. And so that kind of cycle plays out. So when we think about how we manage it, liquidity is key. When we make a commitment to something like this, we tend to want to ride out the waves. We're not going to time this stuff perfectly, but we don't want to either, because we're going to plan it over a 10-year cycle and say, okay, we're going to hire a manager who's going to be investing over the next 3 to 4 years just to get fully invested. Then they're going to start distributing capital back to us. When they start distributing capital back to us, we'll reassess where we are on our asset allocation and determine whether we want to take that money and invest it back, or if we want to say, no, we have better opportunities elsewhere and go elsewhere. But we want to think about it as a long-term investment.
So now, in that field, do we have hundreds of managers to choose from?
Yes and no. There are hundreds of private equity shops out there, without a doubt. When we talk about the fund of funds world.
Is there a ranking system of them? You know, like stocks, you have different categories of quality and different ranking.
Yes.
Who ranks the huge population of fund to fund and private equity?
Same kind of system. There are databases that are going to track their activity. The big focus is on deal flow and how much deal flow they've seen and how much they subscribe
to. If I wanted to go and buy a company, I can go and find out right now its ranking in some categories. So this is kind of a new area for us. I'm trying to figure out, okay, can I go and get something that shows me the entire population? And these are the A, B, C, D kind of...
Basically, the A, B, C, D tiers are going to be based on assets typically. And so what you'll find out in a ranking system like that is who's the biggest. And biggest and success are in some ways tied, but not always. So some of those smaller managers might have departed one of the bigger shops, focus on a niche strategy that they're just very good at doing. And you look at something like that and you're like, that's something we want to be in, but they're not going to show up on those ranking tables.
But if we're going to go into this field, we're going to have to be very careful who we choose.
That's why we would use a fund of funds approach, because that would allow them to create a portfolio for us, because we're not large enough yet to be able to have a whole private equity program. You certainly don't have the investment staff to do it. You would need investment staff to manage that. So that's an effective way of saying, okay, let's find a good fund-of-funds manager, get to know them, understand their strategy, and how they look at those managers.
When you have to have a fund that manages the funds, you have additional costs?
That's right. You have an additional tier. And so that's the trade-off. If you build it yourself, you'd probably pay much more than if you hired them.
Is the business structure the same for a fund of funds as we're experiencing with the private credit? Like you have your LPAs, your GPs?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So we've learned a lot from that process that would help us going forward.
Now, how's the reporting? You know, the big companies have all the requirements, but these fund of funds, are we going to be in the same sort of thing as we are currently, where you need to monitor the reporting to make sure they send everything?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I don't think I would do anything different. Okay. In fact, I don't know. Maybe the fee schedule would be even more or less transparent than what it appears to be now. I don't know.
Well, the fund of funds relationship gives you the relationship with that fund of funds provider or providers, if we wanted two or three or whatever the number is, and your reporting would be coming from them. And that their reporting would be based on the underlying.
But
managers.
Just as you indicated here, we have a blank on our, because it takes time.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
So we can't expect the same speed of.
Right.
Typically a quarter lag. Yep.
So one of the things that I just want to mention is that at some point in time, there may come a time when we come into this room and there's a precipitous drop in this part of the portfolio and we're going to have to resist wanting to change our strategy. I mean, this is truly a buy and hold strategy.
It is. It is. And once you get it set up and you're a few years into it, what we've seen with others is that it's pretty nice how the cash flows start generating. We've had some nice success in that area. So that's a big plus. And it does take some operational conventions we have to get in place to be able to manage the process right, and then it flows from there. Another interesting component too, sorry Rick, is that to get to a funded target, like if we set our target as 10%, it takes them a while to call that money. And by the time they've called all the money, they're already sending money back to us from their realizations, and we never get to 10%.
We have that now.
Yeah, so what you have to do is overcommit. Basically, you have to say, if 10's our target, we're going to commit 15. Now, the risk on that is, what if they actually called all 15?
Yeah.
It hasn't really happened. So could it happen? I guess it could. So we should be prepared for that. And what would we do with our portfolio? But you have to overcommit to ever get to your funded level.
Now, that you're paying during the time of commitment?
Not necessarily. Different managers are different on that. You can pay on invested or on committed. We negotiate hard for on invested.
Okay. What's the typical termination from these investments? I mean, is there a point, at what point in time are you just completely done with a private equity investment? Because I've read a lot of stuff about these investments lingering and lingering and lingering, and they can't get out of it, they can't sell it, there's issues as to why they can't. So what is ultimate resolution in terms of getting out of these investments?
So with a fund of funds, you don't deal with that. They do, and you'll get out of that fund, and they'll close it and move on. And they have the flexibility to take whatever remaining, you know, ghost companies haven't realized and roll them into the next fund and kind of continue it on that way. If you're a larger institution and you have those sitting around, there tend to be either specialty consultants that'll come in and say, I'll buy those from you and take them off your books and I'll manage them, or your investment staff goes in and starts dealing directly with management to get out of it. Yes. Let us flip a few pages ahead. Page 14 and 15 have some historical scenarios. And I think, Sam, this is another way of understanding risk, separate and apart from volatility. These are actual historical scenarios where we take the portfolios and see what they would have done. And this is based on using our benchmarks as the managers as opposed to specific managers. But it gives you a pretty good sense relative to each other. And so if you take the top section here, 2009, July to January, so the big drawdown. I'm sorry, this was the recovery out of the drawdown. You can see how the portfolios behaved. And our current portfolio is the best performing portfolio, so it was the right solution at that time. 2007 to 2009 meltdown, though, it was the worst portfolio. And so you can just see how the different portfolios compared to each other. Some of these are more sizable, like the 2007 to 2009 drawdown. You can tell by the scaling at the bottom of the page. We're talking about 10 percentage points or more from the highest, from the best to the worst performer. Similarly, the 1997 to 99 oil price decline, the bottom set, quite a bit of discrepancy there as well. And so, looking at these different environments. So this can be informative in terms of thinking about how much risk are we taking, what could happen to the portfolio, how bad could this be?
So between 97 and 99, we earned like 37% or something. And over here in 7 to 9, we lost about the same amount?
Right.
Okay.
Right. And then page 16 is the handy heat map. So it's an attempt to try to take the portfolios and think about all of these considerations on one page. And so looking at the risk return metrics at the top and then the risk factors. And I'd note a couple things. One is we rank these relative to each other. So when we say high, medium, and low, it's amongst the options available on the table. It's not that these are absolutes. And the other thing is the liquidity risk, I think, is very interesting, because when we think about the commitments we're talking about with the FFPs to private equity and private credit, FFP 3-year and 4-year actually have medium and low liquidity risk because they have so much in the short-term gov and cash, whereas mixed 1 and 2 actually have pretty high liquidity risk.
Do these, does this heat map differ from the one that we saw last time?
Yes. So the heat map we showed last time was, again, given the portfolios there and how they stacked up relative to each other, and we were looking at things like risk-diversified portfolios and like endowment model and things like that. So this is a different set of portfolios, and so these are relative to each other.
It just seemed like it was slightly different from what I remembered.
Yep. So when we think about next steps, assuming we can come out of today with a selection of an asset allocation, we would then be thinking about how we would update the investment policy statement accordingly to make sure we can implement this all, and then come up with an implementation plan. And that would involve things like what education and searches, etc. So it'd probably take another several months to get this to where we're actually moving dollar amounts.
Someone, I think we need the education for the vote.
What would that do to Graham?
Well, I think we could send you back at a 7.5 if that's the board's pleasure today. And you need something.
Well, it depends when you get something.
We have to get our information to the Board of Supervisors by early May, right, Kathy?
May 15th, so we have to have something final by April. The April meeting, we have to finalize.
So I didn't know if you were interested in having one additional meeting if you wanted to discuss phase-in options or things like that.
Can we discuss phase-in options today?
Yes, I won't have numbers.
Okay. I mean, I did some rough, that's what I was kind of doing in between after your presentation. Assuming that we have a 7.5% discount rate, and given the numbers in your presentation today, we can pretty much nail what the phasing would be.
Yeah, you have option 1 and 2, so both of those are 7.5, one with different inflation and return assumption. But if you're going to stick with your current policy, 7.5 is... off the table, but
right.
You're only expecting a 4%, four or 4.5% real return. So I think you'd have to have some kind of idea of what direction you're heading on these asset mixes before we make a recommendation on the current assumptions. Because current policy, I think, looks a lot different than mix one or mix two or mix three.
So how does the board feel about the general nature of the change from what we currently have? Looking at mix one, two, three, or the FFP portfolios, do one of those mixes seem very likely we would transition to?
My answer is no.
You would be
I'm going to vote no on all of them.
So you're saying keep the course that we're going right now?
Until we have better education and know what we're doing more, yep.
My answer is yes.
Yes, and a particular preference or a general
direction? A switch?
Yeah, on a switch and you know, call me crazy if you want, but I like mix three.
If we were to pick one today, it's probably the one I would pick there. I still have real concerns over the private equity. Maybe I shouldn't, but I'd be too. Mix three is a half there. I just don't know, given the private equity, I don't know if it's the right fit for us or not. I'd have to know more about it before I could allocate anything to that.
But you're okay with the parity, the risk parity?
You say that
you're okay with the risk parity in mix three?
Well, I guess, you know, but there's a lot of variability in that and what you can invest in. Yeah, this is a big change for us.
It's huge.
That's right.
This parity is new. You know, private equity is completely new. I'm not real thankful for that one. Private credit, I'm okay with that one. That seems to work out okay.
In terms of the discount rate, though, there doesn't seem to be much of a range in terms of the expected return across either one of these cases.
One, two, and three all seem to be pretty close.
Yeah, even the current FFPs.
But current policy is 100 basis points different.
Right. Yeah.
So that's, if you're not making any significant changes to your portfolio, your investment consultant is saying they think you're only going to earn 4% above inflation. Well, you set your inflation assumption at 3, that's only a 7% return. You set your inflation assumption at 2.75, that's a 6.75% return. Both of those would be much different in terms of...
Well, wait a minute, though. If your inflation assumption is 2% in this thing,
mm-hmm.
and we subtract that out and add our inflation assumption, that gets us...
From 6 to 7.
5, 3, no. Like mix 2, it's 7% expected return. If we subtract 2 from that, we get 5, and we add 3 back in, we're at 8.
Right, but if your current policy, as you're saying, is what... 6, and their inflation is around 2,
yeah.
So that's a 4% real return. If you reduce your inflation,
you're talking about in today's world.
Yeah, but your inflation assumption right now is only 3.25.
Right.
So 3.25 plus 4 is 7.25. If you reduce your inflation assumption to 3, you're talking about a 7% expected.
Right, I guess I'm assuming that if we magically were able to go to mix 1, 2, or 3, then our investment assumption, our nominal rate of return, is going to be up in the mid to high 7s.
Yeah, in which case I'd probably recommend a margin for conservatism in your assumption.
Yeah, I would too.
We haven't talked about it, but it sounds like prudence says that our discount rate should be 7 instead of 7.5. What does that mean in real dollars per year to the general fund of the plan sponsor?
I'll let you answer that.
So that would be probably another, I just find a ballpark at something like 5% of payroll higher.
Give us a number.
5%. What's your payroll? Yes.
220 million.
5% of 200 million.
Yeah. You're looking at 100.
Yeah, that's a lot.
That is a ton.
So what's the number?
We would pay 7. I mean, we wouldn't take it from 7.5 to 7.1.
11 million.
Another 11 million.
So is that realistic?
Well, it's 7%, so it's certainly more likely. And wanted to be reflective of what's happening outside the room.
And we dropped $13 million 1 year when we stopped doing the pension obligation. So we've seen swings similar to this before. Have we had the discussion with the county?
No, not to this extent.
That's on top of the numbers that I was already talking about.
It's adding 11 more
on top
out of the general fund.
On top of the other $11 million addition that we're already looking at.
Right. Yeah.
So if that's not really on the table, we shouldn't be talking about it. But if you drop it 2.5, say drop it to 7.25, which is closer to reality, that's still adding 5.5 or 6 million.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's more realistic.
But at some point in time, we've got to start using your real numbers. And if 7.5 isn't a real number, then we shouldn't be building a plan on 7.5. If we don't have anything that comes with
I think the new portfolios that are the mixes 1 through 3, they think that they can earn about 5% above inflation on those. So I think 2.75 or 3% is a reasonable inflation assumption. So I think you could be a little more conservative than what they're saying. If you say that you think you're only going to earn 4.5% or 4.75% above inflation. And if you assume inflation is 2.75 or 3, a 7.5% assumption is not unreasonable.
Where are we going to be to other systems at that point?
7.5 is the new normal, is a new median. It used to be 8, and then it was 7.75. I think the median assumption is
7.5. it's 7.75, if we didn't change it by next year, we'd be alone.
Yeah.
So 7.5 would be in a pack.
Would be the median and the mode, I think. It's the most common. Well, I have a couple systems that have gone to 7.25, but most are at 7.5.
That tight a group, huh?
Sorry?
I said, it's that tight a group. They're all at 7.5.
I have one system that's at 7.125. And then there's one plan, Oakland Police and Fire is 6.75, but they're closed. They don't have any active.
I think Orange County's at 7.25 too, aren't they?
Yeah.
So Rick, give us some leadership here. But where do you think we should go?
Well, I gotta tell you, the way I feel is that I am very comfortable with the concept of the FFP portfolios. Because I like the segregation of liabilities, funding towards the duration of those liabilities. This board actually, we discussed this about 2 or 3 years ago, this concept, and this board latched onto that concept. We just didn't have the resources to be able to do anything along those lines. So I like the concept of the FFP portfolios. I do have reservations about the total amount that's going to private equity, whether it's through lending or buying into equity. I don't know if I've heard enough from you to lead me to believe that those two asset classes are not strongly correlated. Even though I heard Graham say 0.13, it's difficult for me to swallow that number. And so I do have strong feelings about the amount that's going into that asset bucket. I think the concept is great. I've always bought into that concept. I love the fact that we would be keeping money on hand for liquidity to pay benefits short term. I love that. I love the fact that we're capitalizing on our long-term liabilities and we can earn an illiquidity premium. It's a give and take here, guys. I mean, that's totally what we've got here. And I guess if you force me to pick one, even though I don't necessarily like that large allocation of that space, I probably would pick one of the FFPs. But I know that that's a difficult pill to swallow.
Well, it sounds like the education is the thing, that there's a familiarity in, like, how can I vote for that if I don't understand it? So,
can I ask a question about the risk parity?
Yes.
And this is just me trying to better understand. I mean, I've done a little bit of reading about it, but certainly not enough. It's not like I've ever traded in it, so I haven't. Mm-hmm. No real sense of it. But sort of the analogy I'm making in my mind is that when they when you passively invest in, say, the S&P, okay, passive investing doesn't mean that the broker goes out and buys one of each of the stocks that comprised of the S&P. What they create is a market basket that relatively reflects those transitions up and down. I mean, it's not an actual one for one. They don't buy IBM, they don't buy Apple, they buy something.
There's a replication process there.
But it's not the exact thing. It's just that it's going to mirror it in its movements. Mm-hmm. And I kind of think of the risk parity as that it's a representation of offsetting risks in your portfolio, but not necessarily of stocks and, you know, fixed income. Is that kind of on the right path, or am I still just off in some other ballpark?
No. You're on the right path. I think a good way of describing it as an analogy is what we do collectively for the plan overall is the same thing that they do, except they have the ability to manage it every day, constantly, throughout the day, whereas we meet monthly. They have sophisticated computer models and everything, monitoring everything to make that happen. And they have the ability to add leverage, whereas we don't, where they want to and within constraints. And when you tie that all together, they're going to try to do essentially what we're trying to do. We're looking at saying, these portfolios generate kind of a 7% return. These portfolios have kind of a 10, 11% volatility. They do the same thing. They say, we want to create a portfolio that has about 10% volatility, and we expect that to generate a return of whatever, 7%. But they have that luxury of constantly monitoring and managing it, whereas we get together on a monthly basis. So they have all the same tools. They just have a lot more of them, and they're more actively managing it. And one of the key differences is how they view volatility. And this is the key component, is that they view volatility on what happened today is being really important. What happened yesterday is also pretty important, but each day prior gets less and less important, and so it has kind of a tail. And so like what happened 10 years ago isn't really important to them, volatility-wise. Whereas we take our volatility and we look at it over a 10-year basis, which is basically capturing 10 years and thinking about it 10 years forward. So they're very sensitive to changes. And that's the key difference, is that whenever they manage their portfolio, if volatility starts increasing and we have fear in the market, they're going to get much more conservative very quickly. And they're going to draw it down and make it a very safe portfolio, which is why they survived 2008 so well. Like, they just completely outperformed public pension plans, because they just dialed down that risk and they waited out. And then as things get safer, then they start dialing the risk back up, and then they're back to normal.
So are they making like micro movements in the market to manage that on like an hourly basis, and I'm going to sell this, I'm going to buy that, because the volatility has moved? Or
it's more of a daily basis.
A daily?
Yeah, it's not high frequency trading or anything like that. Okay.
Question for you on page 8, FFP. If real estate was 14.5 and private equity was 10 and private credit was 14.5, so that your allocation of liquid strategies is the same, mm-hmm. would it change your heat map or whatever the investment model evaluation much in terms of the performance?
So let's just kind of think through this. 14.
So 14.5, 10, 14.5, still is 39.
Yeah, okay.
But it's
gotcha.
Moving us away from the area that we're not as comfortable with.
Right.
They're still illiquid strategies. They still have a higher than normal return. Would it change this map over here very much? It doesn't seem like it would.
It would. I think it would be at the margin. I mean, want to verify that, but I think.
And I wonder if our comfort level wouldn't be better,
right,
as far as the room. It still doesn't address the lack of understanding in all of our parts on the 9 points of risk parity,
right,
which we'd want to have as a focus.
That's right.
In terms of education. But I think we've got to where real estate and private credit we're pretty comfortable with. And just the unknown, and I think it's because we just haven't experienced it. The unknown
right.
is the private equity. although all of us understand private equity, because we've been buying it all the time in United States equities on the stock market.
Right.
This is different. I'm not comfortable with it at all. Especially 15% I could change my mind right now. I just
But I think that's what Jeff is saying. Let's take the 15 down to 10 for one thing. That could be a step in the right direction. And let's do some education on private equity and risk parity and then make that decision. So rather than say,
let's stay with it. There's a story that I personally witnessed here lately. I'm not going to say the name of the company, but there's a $1.5 billion in sales private company that is in the mortuary and funeral home and burial business. Okay, it's not something any of us is going to escape. Mm-hmm. And the management came from a much larger organization. 50% of that company is owned by the state of Washington employee retirement system. 50% of it, and this year they'll return 60% to that fund. And the people look like geniuses. We're not talking about taking that big of a position on anything. We're buying little bits of little bits.
Right.
But there are some much better than publicly traded companies being ran out there that are looking for capital, and they don't want to pay the 15% private credit, so they're selling equity. Mm-hmm. And it's discernible. It's not like witchcraft.
No. Yeah.
And they run it by the numbers and the returns and all that sort of thing.
This is where
we just don't have the experience.
Right. So I think it's going to take more than a month or two to become comfortable and educated on these different types of investments. I think what we need to decide today, though, is that are we willing as a group and an organization to make a change, a commitment to one of these other asset classes? Because Graham cannot go back and do anything if we're going to keep the current asset mix, other than lower the discount rate, probably to below 7%.
I'm about below 7, but it would be lower than 7.5. I think our recommendation would be below 7.
I think you're looking at 7%.
It's tough to see the current mix.
So I think we need to really, the only thing we need to decide today is, are we willing to commit to changing our portfolio? Even though we don't know what it's going to be yet, we need to determine whether we're ready to move away from the way we are currently invested.
Well, I mean, I think there's just too many unanswered parts of that question. Like on emerging markets, you know, I don't support 9% on emerging markets. I just don't. And that's what the FFP3 says. So I think I got a ways to go with it.
So your current portfolio, they're expecting a 4%
real return.
Current inflation assumption is 3.25%, not 3.5% wage growth. So add those together and you're at 7.25%. If you lower inflation expectations, which they're saying their inflation expectation is 2%, we're suggesting either a 25 or 50 basis point reduction in inflation. That gets you to, you know, 4 + 3 = 7.
Graham, you're longer term. What happens if we make a year before we make the change?
I can't sign off on a 7-point. So I have to.
In other words, we're studying this.
You can set the discount rate, right? You have the assumption, but actual standards of practice, which have actually changed recently, say we have to disclose if we think it's reasonable based on the information.
Right.
And your investment consultant that you hired says, look, we think we can only earn 4% above inflation on your portfolio as it's currently structured.
Right.
So I would have to put something in the valuation that said, I would likely have to put something in the valuation that says, I'm not sure if this assumption is reasonable based on the information from your investment consultant and what we think inflation is likely to be.
If we do the education with the intent of looking at seriously changing it, that doesn't give you any comfort.
It does if you tell me, look, we think we're likely to make a change in our portfolio that's going to go to these other diversifying asset classes.
But we're not sure which ones, because we still have differences of opinion as to whether that particular area or that particular area fits.
But what Rick is suggesting is, do you feel like you are ready to commit to a change to something that takes into account one or more of these different things that move? Basically, you're going to sell some bonds, right? That your consultant says you're only going to earn 2 or 3% on, and buy something that you think you're going to earn more money.
But we're not going to earn anything on it because it's the same rate as inflation.
So can we do something? Can we turn to page 9? Maybe this will put our minds at ease a little bit here. If you look at page 9 and you look at the policy, or our current expected return of 6.1 and the standard deviation of 11.1, and then you compare that to, let's say, FFP 2, FFP 3, there'd be no reason at all to stick with the current mix, because we're getting a higher expected return at a lower assumption of risk based on these capital market expectations. Why would you even consider staying at our current
mix? This is historical information. If you believe the world's going to be different, you do different.
It's a 10-year forecast.
Yeah,
it's
prospective.
It's a 10-year forecast, but it's based on history, right?
History factors into it, yeah.
No, I mean, when you decide something's going to earn a certain return, mm-hmm. whether it be private equity or international markets or anything else, what do you do that? Do you crystal ball and say, hey, I think it's going to be this?
No, it's called a building blocks approach. So it starts with an assumption of where inflation is, what the cash rate of return is going to be, and it builds based on risk premiums off of that. So it's not, so history helps us understand the dynamics at play there. So we understand the dynamics, but then when you look forward, we're looking at what that inflation is and a building block approach off of that.
But how much of
so
that
it's kind
is,
of a combination.
How much of that is assumption versus mathematical? In other words, every firm agrees to all the same numbers?
Every investment consultant?
Yeah, if we had different investments.
No, we do compare our numbers to others, and we tend to be in the medium of the ranges, so, yeah. Okay.
I can confirm that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I would say there is another option, which would be bite the bullet and say, okay, our return expectation is 7 or 7.25. Something like that. See what does the contribution rate decide. We're going to phase this in over 3 years. And if by next year you've decided, hey, we're going to look at a different portfolio, you can say, okay, we're ready to increase our expected rate of return. But that's just that's going to be a lot different than what other plans. And I'm not saying you have to make your decision based on
but
what
number would you have to do? Because you're the one saying, I can't approve leaving it. I have to have it lower, or I have to write something.
Assuming you don't do anything different, our recommendation would be, based on what your consultant is saying about your portfolio, would be something like 7 or 7.25%.
So you could give us a report of what 7.25% would do.
Yeah. Now, 7.25% means you're probably leaving that inflation at 3.25%, which I think is kind of high.
Yeah. But, I mean, it's moving the direction.
I mean, it would put you instead of at the upper end of what other systems are doing. But again, not because it matters what your peers are doing, just saying what it would look like. You'd be, you know, back in the front of the game. It's going to be a big increase in the contribution rate, but you could decide to phase that in over a period of time.
Do we have time to get the information from you?
How big an increase?
Again, if I had to just off the top of my head, can you pull up our presentation?
Graham, just so I understand, we're giving you a lot of numbers and scenarios. We sort of need to give you something, a concrete number, so you can start plugging things in.
No, I mean, you have until May. You need something at the
April
meeting.
We have to have the April meeting. We have to set the rates.
We have three meetings between, including April. So I can come back for one more meeting with some options.
But if we don't like it, we give it. Ask you for one more number.
You've got three tries. So that's three tries.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Is sure. Okay. Yeah. Sorry. Is that
sure?
For every quarter point reduction in the real rate of return, you're probably looking at something like another 2.5%, 2 to 2.5%.
That's a good rule of thumb.
Which translates dollar to
$5 million. Yep,
about $5 million. So it's about $5 million per.
You said you're
two and a half.
Yeah, what's your payroll? 220.
220 approximately.
Yeah.
It's another $5 million.
Yep.
Now, we can phase this in over a period of time.
$20 million.
A full what?
A full percentage point is $20 million if we're talking about.
Yeah,
yes.
There's some
yes.
convexity to that. So
that's a good,
yeah.
good approximation.
Okay. Right. So
it might be better because it's not.
If you look at option one, right, and we are going to recommend that you reduce your inflation assumption from 3.25 to 3 or 2.75. Inflation, people just think inflation is going to be low, right? So we would make that recommendation to go down to at least 3, if not 2.75, probably 3. So if you're looking at option one, that's an increase above the current rates without any changes of 5.6% of pay. Okay, if we drop the investment return by another 25 basis points to 7.25,
okay,
you're probably looking at something like, you know, another probably something like 8% of pay increase instead of 5.6. Again, please. This
8% again would be what? Roughly?
The only reason I'm doing this is because another actuary in the room, and he's saying, "Yeah, this sounds right." Right? But
like, we're just dealing in approximations here.
Right.
20 million for 17, 1.4%. But he's talking about
8% of 220 million is payroll.
Gotcha.
Right.
So what? 18.
17.6 is.
Yeah. Over $17 million now. Phase that in over 3 years. It's going to be more than a third because you actually have to pay the interest on the shortfall and so forth. And yes, your employee rates would go up too. So there'd be some splitting of that.
And it's an annual deal, right? So
it would be here this year. Right.
Years, it's three times that number.
Well, no. I mean, it would
end.
Be taking at the end. You would be up to the. You'd be up to higher than 17. Right. So you'd be up at 18, 19, 20 million higher payment than you're paying.
So what, 2 2/3 each year,
yeah.
cumulatively, it would increase.
And if Stan's not having indigestion right now, he should.
Yeah, Mandeep should have fallen off the chair by now.
Okay,
so we go with this, and then next year, or during this next year, we say, hey, we've looked at this, and we think we can find something we live with, changing our profile.
Yeah.
Next year, we could go and say, we can ratchet this back. We don't need $18 million. We can get by with.
So are you suggesting stick with the current, use the discount rate of what, around 7%?
7.25, I think you said.
Well, 7 if you're, so another add another 2.5 on top of that if you're talking about a 3% inflation assumption and they think they can really only earn 4. Now, I may be able to look at some other investment consultants and say, you know what, we could probably get 4.25 out of your investment portfolio, right? But you hired these guys because you know,
we just
you're taking their advice.
Ed, what can we do in the next month or two in terms of education? Is there anything we can do that would make us feel more comfortable? Or do you think we need more time?
Well, we have a couple areas to educate, right?
Right.
Yeah, it sounded like private equity, risk parity, and emerging markets.
Yeah.
Were the three topics. I wouldn't recommend doing all three of those at once.
No.
ideally, one at a time.
Okay.
And what I could do with each, let's see, private equity, I think there would be a strong candidate to do kind of like what Medley did in terms of come in as an educational mm-hmm. session purely, which could augment what I could give you. But there you'd get the chance to ask the questions about how's the fund of funds work and give you some comfort there, which I think would be better if you heard it from them. Risk parity, I could probably cover that one pretty straightforward. Emerging markets, I could probably cover that one pretty straightforward as well.
It'd be nice to have somebody who does risk parity to be able to have some real life.
Yeah.
I don't know if you can find somebody.
I mean, we could come back with what option one looks like, except a 7.25 and a 7.5% return assumption, and just tell you what the numbers are.
Yeah. Again, how long would that take you?
I can have that at the next meeting.
Oh, okay.
But I think we need to answer Rick's question. I don't want to go through an exercise
right.
that's meaningless if people say, hey, no, this is what we're doing and we're going to stick with it. You know, if there's no appetite to change our portfolio, why waste your time, my time?
Well, I think Rick nailed it on page 9. You have as a fiduciary in front of you a report showing you that the current portfolio is what is known as inferior to the options. You have several options in front of you that offer both a higher return potential with a lower risk potential and a lower drawdown potential. How can you not take action? How can you not pursue the education?
Congratulations.
That's how long would it be if we chose one of these before we come back and do another study based on what's happening in the marketplace and consider a rebalance or consider a change?
Our capital market assumptions are updated annually. This study was done on last year's, and our new ones will be coming out in a matter of weeks, maybe a month. So we could actually update this as soon as that and then do an annual review if we wanted to. We generally recommend to clients to do it on a 3-year basis because the numbers just don't change that much year to year. So, you know, rather than just make it an academic exercise, make it something valuable.
I wouldn't have any problem with that week 3. Mm-hmm. But hearing the concerns in the room, if you look at mix 1, it reduces risk parity by almost half. It reduces emerging market by almost half. Mm-hmm. And if the same held true as what we discussed before, if you went to the illiquid strategy and you went 12.5, 5, and 12.5 there.
Yeah. So one point to note on mix 1, 2, and 3 is that they introduce emerging market debt, and you see hard and local. So there's another wrinkle to those portfolios as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess there's another 5%
there
that yeah. Probably wouldn't be happening.
Right.
Right.
More education.
Right. What is the difference there? Emerging markets, debt, hard and local.
So some emerging market countries issue debt in their currency, and that's the local version. Some of them will issue it in U.S. dollar, Japanese yen, British pound, a hard currency like that. So then it depends on who's taking on the currency risk.
They could devalue the currency.
Yeah, there are minefields either way because there's the currency risk, but yeah.
Well, I'm not against making change, all right? But I am against making change because we have one analysis that says we're going to get 1% return or 1.0 return. Without being convinced. And I don't think, like a lot of the emerging market stuff, I think we're in for a very difficult time for the next 10, 15 years internationally. I think the world is in for a difficult time. And I don't think we're going to have booming markets and stuff. So I just think we should be wary.
You know, I'm okay with making a change, but when you go from domestic equity to 38%, mix 3 is 25. I just hate to go below that. And then, you know, some of these other ones are 10% or less on domestic equity, which I think is the staple of the world.
Yes, it's the fuel of the whole world economy.
Well, getting anything lower than 25%, I'm not sure I can.
Well, private equity is domestic equity. It's just a question whether it's traded public or private.
Right.
So. Well, yes, exactly. There's the liquidity component. And, you know, a big factor in all that is fewer companies want to be public today because of the regulatory requirements. So if you don't have to be, why would you be? And that's a key driver of the macroeconomic theme of why the private markets have exploded as much as they have because of Dodd-Frank and Sarbanes-Oxley and those kinds of things. Tremendous stress on a company to report.
Boy, does that lead into political issues.
I'm sorry. Sarah Palin endorsing Trump.
Yeah, he does. Trying to guess what's going to happen next year. Oh, goodness.
So what do we want to do? So what do we want to do? I stand by what I said at the last one. You know, for me, I like the FFP, but I can't see this board moving in that direction. I think that's, for me, that was my preference at the last meeting, and it remains my preference now.
what education do you think would help to be able to get a resolution?
I would personally love to have somebody come in who trades the risk parity, just because it's a product that I'm not that familiar with, and it's fascinating, you know, to me how that model is built and how they're making their decisions where to move into and out of. To me, that's really interesting. So I would like that, just because I'd like that. But I just see this as a difficult sell to get the board to move that far that quickly.
So can I make a suggestion? My suggestion would be to put the brakes on a little bit on this, because I agree this is a pretty good switch here for us. Let's take some time. Let's look at this. Graham has said that he feels confident that he can go back with our current mix for the time being and use a 7.25% discount rate. It's going to cause a large increase in contributions, but we can phase that in over 3 years, and after the end of 1 year, we can change the nature of the game again after we've had more time to analyze these other mixes. But it will cause more of an increase in the employer rate in at least the first year, even if we do phase it in.
But that's after a decrease this year.
So,
yeah.
It would all of
it's going to affect this year's contribution.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. They're not going to go down
next
and back up. They're just going. They're going up anyway because of the mortality assumption changes.
So I think it buys us a little time, gives us a little more flexibility, and it doesn't lock us into anything, into high employer contribution rates, should we decide to switch going forward.
So do we need to make a motion?
I think so, yeah.
Yes, you do.
Does anyone have a motion that they want to make?
We could make a motion to lower the rate down
to 7.25 over the next 3 years.
Okay.
And that would be the only thing we would be deciding today then.
Okay, I'll make a motion.
I think what I was discussing would be you would actually lower the rate to 7.25 today.
Oh.
But you would phase in the impact over a 3 year.
Yes.
But
okay.
What
I
meant.
So that. I knew that.
We would be bound by that discount rate for 3 years. If after we've done our
time. Now, my recommendation in terms of what the report would say will probably say 7 because it's, you know, there 4 plus the inflation 3. But I won't say that if you say a 7.25, I'm not going to say that's an unreasonable assumption and you know,
okay.
Put a sticky
just that
note
you would like
mouth.
To see us move towards 7.
Right.
Should ceteris paribus.
Yeah. Exactly.
Absent any other changes, your recommendation would be 7.
Based on the data that we got. Now, I'm not, but I wouldn't say that 7.25 is unreasonable.
Right, I got you.
Yeah. I'll make the motion, as you said, to 7.25. Phased in 3 years so that he can do his calculation.
Is there a second? Is there an alternate motion?
Well, let's go back to the question about why we have to do this today. Why can't we do this next month?
We could push it off, but we're not going to be able to study these new types of investments in enough time to get Graham off and running for our contribution rate for 16.7.
Well, he can come back with the figures on the 7.25 next time.
Sure,
even
absolutely.
Without a motion.
If I second Gordon's motion and we have a vote, it would also say that we are not going to change the current investment policy.
For now.
Exactly.
This
it just buys us a little time, that's all we're doing.
I'll second Gordon's motion. We'll have a vote on it.
Should we do a roll call?
You have to, please.
Okay.
Jim DeMartini?
Aye.
Michael O'Neill?
Yes.
Jeff Grover?
Yes.
Donna Riley?
Yes.
Sam Sharp?
Yes.
Mike Lynch?
Yes.
Gordon Ford?
Yes.
Motion passes.
So I just wanted direction. Do you want me to come back with a final val report with these numbers, or just what the numbers are?
I think you can come back with a final val report.
And Rick, can you get together with Stan or whoever needs to know exactly what we did today?
Yes.
So I know where's one. Yeah.
think you get.
And also, the next meeting, if other people want to come from the CEO's office to better understand, you know, the budget team perhaps, that wouldn't be unwarranted, so that they can understand what impact this is going to have over the next several years.
Hopefully we can get our education studies.
Well, that's what I was going to bring up next. We should think about how we want to schedule these in. So I think three in one session.
We'll also have a firm here next month, won't we?
Legato's coming.
So yeah. We'll have Legato, and then if we want to have an education study, what is that going to do to the...
I mean, the length of time?
Are we going to...
What do we have Legato calling?
We could do that.
I don't
or
disagree.
Or we could put them off.
We can do that.
Yeah, well,
let's have a 20-minute call in, and that gets it off our plate.
I think that's an excellent idea.
I can't imagine they'd be unhappy with that.
No. And, well, I'll save that for comments afterwards, because I know I'm not allowed to make that remark now.
So maybe we can tackle risk parity and perhaps emerging markets, because you said you could do that yourself in February.
Well,
I think it'd be better with somebody who's done risk parity to be able to ask.
Oh, I'm sorry. Did I?
No, you're right. I think in response to Donna's request, though, having someone in here would be.
Oh, okay.
I would really love to hear somebody who actually trades in that market.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
It'd be so interesting.
Yeah, okay, we can do that.
So you'll set that up and get back to me on that?
Yes.
Okay.
So risk parity, and then definitely for February, and then.
Yes.
What else do we want to do then?
Emerging market.
Well, could we hear what the 37 Act universe of private equity is?
Absolutely.
I mean, what's the rest of our peers doing in that private equity? What's their experience been? I mean, if we don't have any experience ourselves, at least we could look at what the rest of the world has been doing, because we don't know that.
Would you want that in risk parity too?
Sure, I think it would be part of knowing what's going on.
Yeah. So private equity, most if not all, have exposure to it, except for the smaller ones.
Okay.
I wasn't
how long
sure.
Have they been in it?
Do they have 20%, 50%?
That's what I was
just thinking. It's in the
Army Kings Report.
Yeah. Right. We can do that.
So sort of a whole profile of it.
Yes.
I have one.
Yes.
November, right?
This is very interesting to me, just digesting the thought leader and peer risk sensitivity is very low. But step one, let's find out what the other Sackers counties are doing first. Okay, well, I got you.
Well, you saw how it went the other way.
Yes, absolutely. So we'll tee up risk parity for February, and then I want to figure out when we get in private equity and emerging markets. So emerging markets... Also for February?
If we can.
If you can.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Might be pushing it, but hey.
Your call.
And then private equity for March.
Okay. What's your February meeting date?
Okay, so I think that's all we need to do on item 8. So after that is closed session, and we have a closed session item, don't we?
We do.
Yes,
we
do.
Okay. Does anyone have to excuse themselves? Yes.
Yeah.
In that case, we're going to move into closed session. Does the board want to take a break or anything?
We've been in the best room.
Yeah, let's take a 5-minute break. All right, 10-minute break. We're back in open session.
I have a readout from closed session for item 9A. A motion was made by Trustee O'Neill and seconded by Trustee DeMartini to commit $35 million to the Raven Fund 3. A roll call vote was taken. Roll call is as follows. Trustee DeMartini, yes. Michael O'Neill, yes. Jeff Grover, yes. Donna Riley, yes. Sam Sharp, yes. Mike Lynch, yes. Gordon Ford, no. Motion carried 6-1. There was a second motion made by Trustee O'Neill to appoint Trustee Grover to the advisory committee and was seconded by Michael O'Neill. Motion carried unanimously.
Sam.
No.
Sorry. The second motion was to, was made by Mike O'Neill and seconded by Sam Sharp to appoint Trustee Grover to the Advisory Committee of Raven 3 Fund. Motion carried unanimously.
Great. Okay, so
Grover left the room.
Yes, and Grover left the room and abstained from that vote.
So, members forum. Right?
Nothing.
Pass.
Since our meetings are open and public and the various information and everything is on the agenda in public, occasionally I get contacted by people of the public who are firms who want to get into the field or do something. I'm going to refer them to Verus unless directed otherwise.
Correct.
Okay.
Pass. Nothing.
Pass.
I actually have two items. One, I would like to have a standing 10-minute break at 3 o'clock. If we're going to be here from 1 to 5, we need a stretch break at 3 o'clock.
Donna, you don't have to ask.
I don't?
No, you
can call a break.
Oh, that's right.
Talk to the chair. She can call
it's
break.
It's going to be on the agenda from now on.
Anything you want.
Yay! Such power. Okay, so the next thing is I would really like to consider having GoToMeeting installed for us to have brokerage firms do it in some sort of electronic format rather than always having people come out. And I would that be something that the rest of the board would be interested in?
Well, why don't you, GoToMeeting is a particular company, right?
Some sort of electronic video conferencing.
So can we build that into the new room?
We could certainly do that.
I think that'd probably be wise to do that.
I mean, I just...
You're not talking about immediate. You're talking about...
I think we ought to move in that direction. The having people fly out here, and it just seems to take longer. We could accomplish the same thing electronically, having them video in.
Is that something that is a big expenditure, big enough to need a vote or not?
I don't know.
Well, just to... Just to explore it.
Explore
it, and technology has gotten so much better that it's probably, I'm sure it's a fraction of what it was even 5 years ago when we looked at it. I know Verus actually uses a couple of televisions and a computer and Skype.
With a strong Wi-Fi, you're probably...
Exactly. There's things we can do. So whether or not...
I would really like us to explore
we've
that.
Definitely, we can, if the board wants us to... move forward with that, we will definitely explore it and get a cost.
Thank you. That would be great. Is there anything else?
I have one question I forgot about. What did we ever decide to do about these power lines?
Burying the power lines. So, interesting you say that.
Go ahead. We got a lot of good...
Kathy.
I looked at just to see what anything...
Aren't they awful?
Okay. They are awful. And we have been going back and forth with county on it. And MID gave Rick a quote, and when we went to Capital Projects, they questioned some of the details. So we now have, I was told about a week ago, Chris Brooks, who is a maintenance engineer who has been assigned to Capital Projects, has been directed to work with MID to move this thing forward. I don't know exactly what that means yet. There still has to be budget for it somewhere on the county side, but it didn't fall into a black hole. We are still moving it forward, and we are being the squeakiest wheels we can get away with. So at this point, I'm actually hopeful. This is the most we've had movement on it in a while. Patty Hill Thomas, who is in charge of Capital Projects, has instructed Chris Brooks, a maintenance engineer assigned to Capital Projects, to see what he can do about moving this thing forward. So that's as official as I have at this point in time.
Our share was estimated to be somewhere around 100 grand. Right?
I think it's going to be less than that, actually, given the new information that we have.
It's not insurmountable. Well, we built this building and looked at it, and they told us millions.
Yeah, it's not even close to that.
Wasn't MID
millions?
Yes.
$2 million, if you consider it, we might beat you up for some more.
Yeah. It'll be next fiscal year to get it into the county's budget. Even though it's not a big cost, they have issues with that.
But we're getting some movement, which is more than we've had in a long time.
Oh, absolutely.
So I know that doesn't sound real good, but that's what county I have.
Half the deal, right?
Yeah, three of the six floors. Yeah.
We have one in the private.
Correct.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
It's not that much.
No.
It's not
because they're not going to do the whole block. They're only going to do from where the parking garage ends to the end of the block. So that's a big saving. It comes down. So is there anything else? Then we are adjourned.